show starts now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. It looks like education still under attack as we march into, and I love this, it's School Choice Appreciation Week. Yay! It's Voucher Week. It's Charter Week. Oh, boy, can't wait. What it really is, it's Destroy Public Education Week, pure and simple. It's Destroy What We the People Have Week. It's Destroy. It's Take Away. It's Destroy That Future. And we're going to talk about it all week long. Also going to talk to some hospital workers who are demanding that they, well, you know, that they themselves have health care, that they can afford it. Kind of a novel thought if you think about it, that they have some say in their workplace. And, oh, by the way, advocating for the people that they're taking care of as the corporate bean counters. And, no, it's all about the profit. We're health care secondary to our profit. Operations and all of that stuff, secondary to the bottom line. So we'll talk about that. Also, we're going to talk about last week's court decision on the Obama's recess appointments to the NLRB, which have been ruled unconstitutional by a crazy right-wing court. And again, this is another example of why the right has been able to get away with so much. They fight, they block, they obstruct, they filibuster every nomination, every appointment. There's been nothing easy for this administration. And go back to the Clinton years. There were no easy appointments during the Clinton years either. And everyone goes, oh, well, you know, the Democrats fought Bork. Yeah, there's one. there's one. What about the rest of them? Do you think we'd have the Supreme Court that we have now if Democrats bought the same scorched earth mentality that the Republicans have? Absolutely not. We'll talk a little bit about that. Also, the wealthy, not very happy. In fact, quite unhappy. Or at least the guy who is the seventh wealthiest athlete in the world, golfer Phil Mickelson. You may remember me talking about him complaining that he was going to have to pay 63% of his take in taxes. And if you remember me saying 63%, the math not there. In fact, the math not even close. I hope he plays golf a lot better than he does math, because not even close. People in his strata pay about 30% total. It is what it is. But we'll talk about that. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Lots of stuff came out this weekend. A ton of... You know, the lottery is still being privatized. The wine and spirit shops back up on the auction block. The pension situation, that's going full tilt boogie. You know, at the end of this, and I've said this for a while, the deals are already done. All of the stuff, I think, already done. It's a matter of how the GOP is going to roll them out. What kind of sugar they're going to put with the poison for you to swallow it? How are they going to coat the poison that they're going to ram down your throat? That's what this is really all about. And it's going to be, well, you know, okay, well, we won't do anything to the pensions so bad. We'll just sell off those wine and spirit shops and screw all those workers and screw that whole thing up. And, oh, by the way, you know, all of the things that come with it, the big campaign contributions, the lower tax revenue for the state, you know, all of that stuff, you know, less control over what happens societally. You know, but that's never mind. And remember, it's ideology. And then the push, you know, all the privatization, all of the destruction of education, all of the destruction of social programs, all of that's part of the No Rights at Work agenda. But nothing more central to the no rights at work agenda that the right wing in this country is pushing than this so-called right to work nonsense. And you know, you point to Indiana, who lost 56,000 jobs since passing it. And you go, well, I thought it was going to create jobs. Wrong. All of the destruction of labor rights in Wisconsin, like 46,000 jobs, gone. Thought it was going to create jobs. Never about that. Never about that. And now you see this push here in Pennsylvania. And look, there's a lot of money going to be flowing in here. And you're going to hear right to work. And they're going to make it sound so wonderful and so, and that these southern states have it so wonderful that, you know, there's a lot of manufacturing going on down there. So Pennsylvania has to be like everybody else. We've got to race because, you know, we got to steal from Ohio, or we got to steal from New Jersey, or we got to steal from New York, we got to steal from Maryland, we even got to steal from the southern states. That's how low conditions have to get. We've got to be stealing from each other. Because that's what employers want. And it works pretty well for them. So there's this whole push, and I love this article that I saw in the Wall Street Journal that points pretty much what I said. There's a study evidently by the good folks at the American Legislative Exchange Council. You may know them as ALEC. They're the people who brought you the stand your ground gun laws and a lot of the voter suppression stuff and a lot of model legislation, pro-business stuff, because that's what it's funded by. But, you know, they've come out with their study that they claim new factories and facilities are much more likely to open up in southern states and in states without, you know, forced unionism. Understand, no one's forced to join a union. That's the federal law as it is. You don't have to join. You have Beck rights. Pretty simple stuff. And but they don't want you to know that. And then this article points out about Rick Snyder in Michigan, who had said at one point that he wasn't in favor of this because it's divisive and it was just too politically divisive. He wasn't interested in it. And I like how they said, supporters note that Michigan Governor Rick Scott didn't back right to work until he became persuaded of its value to create in creating jobs. Now, the argument, the reason that he says he's doing it, is going to create jobs, because the American Legislative Exchange Council, the business group, the business front group, is saying, hey, we've got this study that we concocted. It's going to create jobs. We know it is. And I'm sure they persuaded him with a boatload of cash. You look at what the governor said recently, and it kind of blows my mind because, hey, it's about creating jobs, right? He said, quote, over 90% of the jobs that you're looking at aren't going to be in a situation where right to work is even relevant. He says, let's not live in Michigan's, in the past of Michigan where we fought. Let's learn from it and recognize that we're in the Michigan of 2013, but let's be planning for the Michigan of 2025 and a great place for all these young people. And you stop and you think about this. Okay, well, you're talking about 2025 down the road, great young people, all of this stuff. You've been gutting education. You've been gutting the social safety net. You've been gutting health care. You've been gutting everything that those young people need. And now, thanks to this position, what you've done is you've broken the ladder into little pieces that would have led them to the middle class. Because as he points out, less than a fifth of people in Michigan belong to labor unions. So this idea that, well, you know, the companies are, you know, they're not coming because, you know, all these people, not working. What you're talking about doing is crushing those organizations and lowering wages for everybody. And as I've been listening to all of this talk about, well, you know, labor's only, you know, organized labor's only 7% of the private sector workers. So explain to me why it is that we need to crush them even further. Oh, yeah, because they generally support people who support them. They generally want, you know, raises in minimum wage, and they generally want safe working conditions, and they generally want good schools, and they generally want to protect the community. They generally want to do a lot of very progressive stuff that, you know, the authoritarian right doesn't want. So, you know, what I've been hearing, and I've been listening since the BLS numbers came out and pointed out another 400,000 union members gone in 2012. What I find interesting is that the right wing has taken on to this message of, well, you know, it's all about choice. You know, workers have chosen not to join because there's not a value proposition there. Like it's some kind of commodity. It's like you're buying life insurance. And that, you know, they just chose to. The employer, the broken labor laws, none of that, you know, the harassment, the intimidation, none of the forced captive meetings, none of that stuff had anything to do with it. The employee on his own simply goes, you know what, I don't see the value in it. Yet when you see survey after survey, 60 to 70% of people who are surveyed say, I would love to join a union. I would do it tomorrow if I could. So what the right's telling us is a bunch of nonsense. What the Republicans are spewing, as always in my view, is a bunch of corporate nonsense. I was thinking of a different word there. Then you get other folks who are, you know, are saying, well, you're trying to be a little more factual basis, and you got to give them credit, they're trying. They go along the lines of, well, you know, the decline in union membership linked to deindustrialization. There's a lot of truth to that. As manufacturing moved to those southern right-to-work states, you know, the ones who had no voice whatsoever, and they were exploitable and cheap as they moved south, yeah, you lost some membership. But guess what? They didn't just stop in the south because even those workers were too expensive. Then they moved to Mexico, and then they moved to Asia, and eventually they're going to move to Africa because that's where the cheaper labor even still will be. And you look at this and you go, oh, okay, well, there's something to that. And then they make the argument, well, you know, then unions, they shifted their organizing to the public sector. Because obviously teachers and cops and firefighters and other government workers, you couldn't ship those jobs overseas as easily. And what I like about that is, you know, it's those unions, the unions, they shifted. What I like about the argument is they make the unions sound like some viper sucking up all these workers and spitting them out. And it's a good right-wing frame. They're just using you. Not that they've made your conditions better, not that they've gotten you better wages and benefits and, you know, some health care, some retirement, avoid none of that stuff. No. Hey, let me let you in a little bit of reality. Just a little reality check. Unions are the workers. Just like government is the people. The people who fight for the contracts so that they can make their lives a little safer, maybe a little more prosperous, maybe with a shred of dignity. That's the people. That's you and me. And as I've been saying about the Walmart jobs and the retail jobs and the fast food jobs and all of the, what's left here, what the wealth class has not sucked out of our borders, what can't be moved, those have to be the jobs of the next generation that are going to provide that decent living, that are going to provide the ability to take a vacation and put food on the table and a roof over your head. Go back to the 50s and 60s when the public sector workers couldn't organize. Back when cops and firefighters and especially teachers and sanitation workers, back before they could, what were those jobs like? Well, those were the jobs that most of them that nobody really wanted because they didn't pay very well. But because folks organized, because they came together and said, you know what? We demand this to be a middle class job because work has dignity. And if you go to work, you punch the clock, you do your best, you play by the rules, and I love that frame, play by the rules. If you do that, you should be able to not just exist or survive, but to actually live. And that's what we got to start talking about again from this day forward. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
You're You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that the federal court decision in Washington, D.C. by a panel of Republican judges overturning President Obama's appointments for NLRB board members is nothing less than shocking. Trumka says in a radical and unprecedented decision, that court panel interpreted the Constitution in such a way as to deprive presidents of both major parties of a critical tool that they have used hundreds of times over the years, the recess appointment. Obama had appointed NLRB members during a congressional recess, but Republicans used a parliamentary trick to technically stay in session to block Obama's appointments. Trumka says the AFL-CIO strongly disagrees with this court decision and expects it to be reversed on appeal. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says her union also strongly disagrees with the decision, and she says SEIU is confident that these National Labor Relations Board appointments will be upheld as the appeals process moves forward. On Tuesday, the Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan, or MAFAN, will gather for an event supporting Nissan workers who want a union at the plant in Canton, Mississippi. Actor-activist Danny Glover will join clergy, elected officials, the Mississippi Student Justice Alliance, and civil rights leaders in the rally to support union organizing at Nissan. As President Obama prepares to move forward on immigration reform, SEIU says that a new national poll shows a solid majority of American voters back immigration reform that includes a path to earned citizenship. The poll, sponsored by SEIU, America's Voice Education Fund, and National Immigration Forum, was conducted by Public Opinion Strategies, that's a Republican polling firm, and Hart Research Associates, a Democratic firm. 4 out of 5 voters in that poll said they support a system that requires immigrants to pay taxes, holds employers accountable for hiring legal workers, and prevents them from exploiting immigrant labor. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has until the end of today to sign legislation that would raise the state's minimum wage and provide an annual cost of living increase. The New Jersey AFL-CIO is urging the governor to sign the bill. The Labor Federation says it believes raising the minimum and providing cost of living adjustments will help not only low-income workers, but also as a first step toward combating growing economic inequality. The AFL-CIO says if Christie doesn't sign it, the Labor Federation will aggressively pursue a constitutional amendment to get it done.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW, the OPEIU, and the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your working class radio experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Bring shit out of robbery. Bar the shirt that you can't be on. Blue denim, hell is bait. Oh, he's a working class.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So last Thursday, the professors of the Pasha universities here and colleges here in Pennsylvania took to the streets and said, hey, you know what, it's been almost 2 years. This contract should be done by now. We should be not having to be fighting about, talking about this. It should just be done. I mean, at some point, you got to go 2 years, enough already. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen. There's a strike vote authorization, I guess, being taken. You just wonder why people can't come to the table and sit down and bargain in good faith, which is why I've asked Dr. Paul Quinn, physics professor at Kutztown University, to come talk to us about what's going on with their contract negotiation. Paul, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, how you doing? It's a shame. I agree. I've listened to your intro, and it's a shame that we're still here talking about these negotiations because this should have been wrapped up a long time ago. For some reason, they continue to drag something on that shouldn't be dragged on. It's very simple. We just want what they gave all the other unions. And, instead of going forward and growing programs and teaching our classes and doing the things that we want to do, we got to be faced with the situation that we have now.
Yeah, part of me goes, this is an ideological battle, because I look at the guy who's the chancellor and going, I guess, moving on to bigger and better things here pretty soon. I guess he's made a name for himself. How much of it do you think is the ideological battle? And do you think that if he leaves, things will change, or does the rest of the board seem to be as entrenched as he is?
You know, I'm really not sure. It's really hard to read the landscape because what they're doing just doesn't make any sense. You know, from the very beginning, it didn't make sense. I mean, if you really wanted to get this contract done, right, I mean, no one works well under this tension. Administrators don't, the faculty don't, the students don't. And the way they've stalled and taken their time and how really there's been no movement at all until, you know, some flurries of stuff here and there. I mean, if I look at the situation, having been through, you know, seen two other negotiation processes, the kind of negotiations that we're having now, we should have been having this 2 years ago, right? So the fact that we're doing this now just doesn't make any sense. There's no logic to it. As far as our contract goes, I mean, you know, the compensation piece is really not what the issue is. So all this talk about saving money and, you know, the professors are costing the students money for tuition, I mean, that's all done, right? We have the same thing that all the other unions got as far as that goes, right? We're arguing about issues, and I don't really understand other than then you know, they just want to privatize and destroy the state system. That's, you know, that's all I can conclude from the situation.
Because, you know, when I look at this and some of the folks that I've talked to who are members of APSCUF, you know, the one theme keeps popping up, these adjunct professors that they want to be able to do, I guess, whatever they want. And, I look at this model that I see the future of education, not just in higher ed, but K through 12, this for-profit model where, you know, the more you can pay, the, you know, the easier it's going to be and big profits and not much for you and me.
No, I agree, but, you know, they're just whittling down the quality. I mean, you know, one of the beauties of our state system and the unionized environment has helped create is that you have a great education, right, that's affordable, and you have these great professors. You know, I got so many colleagues I've gotten to know through the union, and it's these great professors that really want to be there and work with the students. Well, you know, you keep going through, forget the package itself, even the hassle of having to go through this every year, every 4 years. I got to argue for respect, right? You know, we're people that are at the top of our field in what we do. I mean, what better for students to learn from? And to go through this process is very draining. It's going to get harder and harder to get people to come to the state system and stay.
Yeah, so let me ask you that, because, you know, I've had this conversation with a number of teachers who are about, you know, not just college professors, but K through 12 educators saying, you know what, I've just had enough. I've had enough of the obstruction. I've had enough of the factory mentality, and I'm just going to go somewhere else. And the question then is, what are we left with?
Well, you're going to be left with a very poor system that's pieced together with adjuncts. And I'm not saying that, you know, all adjuncts are bad, but as an adjunct professor, you use it to build your career, then move forward and become full-time elsewhere, right? You don't have continuity for the students. You don't have people that are necessarily at the top of their field as much as, you know, a full tenure professor that's invested in the institution. You don't have people that would care as much as care much about the institution as they would as if they were tenured and invested there. They're going to have a terrible system. And, you know, they're constantly asking to do more with less, but in this case, you know, the money argument just doesn't fly. It's almost like it's about some kind of control. Like, and, you know, one of the thoughts I've had is that we have this governor, right, you know, Tom Corbett, who really is an enemy of education in this state, has just got this upper hand, and no one wants to go against him and tell him that this attack on education has to stop. So these underlings that he has, they just march in line. And, you know, they're trying to gain this control because, again, the issues we're stuck on are not really monetary.
Yeah, I saw something about health care. Also, that the chancellor had brought up some claims about the health care that the faculty gets.
Yeah, and so they're claiming that the health care that we get, right, is going to bankrupt the system and all this other stuff. And, you know, there's a couple responses to that. One is, they didn't ask any of the other unions to make the concessions they're asking us to make, right? I mean, you look at AFSCME. You know, their health care didn't change much at all, right? So, and they're a big union in the state. You know, and the chancellor also likes to go and say that he negotiated with the other unions. No, he didn't, right? I mean, he didn't. The governor did. And the governor said that those contracts were fair. So it's a mystery to me why the governor can say that those contracts are fair, but we have a chancellor who's now no longer going to be here is saying that our contract has to be different, right? So it's almost like you're picking on the faculty. And, you know, I don't understand that.
Well, I mean, how much of it do you think is pitting not only you against AFSCME, but you against your members? Because
if
you could divide things up.
Absolutely. You divide and conquer. And what has to be clear is, you know, one of the things that we're negotiating is the health care for retirees, right? So when you retire, you take your health care into retirement. They want to eliminate that. And, you know, they use this argument that, you know, the cost and basically what has happened is the system has changed its accounting. So if the entire state system was to go away at once, right, and then you had to suddenly pay for everyone's health care that retired at once, sure, you'd have this huge liability. But that's not going to happen, right? I mean, that's an almost impossible situation. So the fact that they use that to justify their budgets is terrible. But, you know, what they want us to do is to give up this health care for retirees. But at what cost, right? You have to think about the future. I mean, you know, what respect do people get to become professors, right? I mean, others won't think so, but I think that we're constantly having to argue that we deserve to be paid, right? We constantly have more rules and regulations and people that don't know education trying to control our curriculum, right? And now they want to go after your health care. And you know that as soon as they go after the health care for retirees in the future, why are people going to come here, right? You want to attract a good faculty and keep the system the way it's going to be. You know, you have to have a fair contract, things that people are going to want to come for. I mean, you know, it's not the money. You can go to a private college and make more.
Yeah, I seem to remember a right-wing argument about competition and incentives and meritocracy. And I seem to remember maybe you as a college professor would have a better idea of, you know, how it is you attract people. You know, there's certain things that bring them, you know, like health care, like decent wages, the respect that you're talking about. Yeah, I seem to remember them talking about something like that.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, and I know it's funny because my parents were both in unionized environments. They were teachers in a K-12 system. And, you know, they never got the respect they deserved either. I'm not sure how you get people to see it because, you know, there's things that we put up with here in the state system that you don't have to put up with necessarily the same manner at other colleges, right? And it's one of the things that, you know, you could say, oh, I could go into, you know, I mean, as a physics professor, I could go into industry and make double what I'm making. I mean, there's calls for engineers with all kinds of energy conservation, all that kind of stuff, right? So I'm here because I like to work with these students. And, you know, one of the things that keeps professors like us, you know, at a place in the state system is the type of students we have. These students are fantastic, right? They're not these upper echelon, you know, the sons and daughters of rich families. These are hardworking students. I have so many students in my classes that are first-generation college students. And when they're done with our program, I can put them against these upper echelons, supposedly, right? And my students come out on top. I mean, I've got students that have gone on for graduate work at places like UPenn and, you know, Penn State and all these other schools that people, you know, look up to. The type of students that we have, their work ethic is unmatched. And it's a shame that the governor wants to remove opportunities for these hardworking, you know, a lot of them blue-collar family students, right, and destroy the opportunity to go and not only compete, but I would say that our students can best those other students that come from the more upper-class families.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I look at what this governor has said for almost day one, that it's not, you know, not look at what we should privatize. It's look at what we're going to privatize. And it just looks to me that this is another thing on the chopping block, something for them to, you know, to fire sale off.
Oh, it is. It's terrible. I mean, it's this whole... He has this whole attack on education, and one of the things I try to strive to the faculty members, they got to see the big picture. It's not just about our contract and how we're getting paid. You know, sometimes when you're so busy working with students, you can get myopic and not see the big picture. But this is about a general attack on education, and it stems from the top governor right on down. You know, they want to take this business model, which doesn't work, and they want to apply it to a situation where you can't just look at business models. You have to look. People. They're not, you know, products. They're people that you want to try to work because ultimately they'll become part of society and make it better.
Yeah, I see. I'm not a big fan of the commodification of education. To me, it's not a commodity. It's a common good. It's a societal good, and it's something that we should be fighting for because I'm of the mindset that that education is the hill we have to die on because, you know, that is our democracy. That's what the nation, I believe, the fabric of this nation is.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, without education, what do you have? You have a bunch of sheep that follow these small elite that are in power, and they just do whatever they want to do. You know, that's a terrible way to have things go.
Yeah, so let me ask you this. I mean, does it look like we're anywhere closer? I understand there's a strike authorization vote coming. Is there a strike imminent? Where's this going?
We had, let me just make sure, so the process, we had a strike authorization vote in the fall. The membership voted to allow the negotiations committee to call for the strike if they feel it's necessary.
Okay.
And we have a negotiations on February 1st, and that's going to be a big date. because it depends what happens there. You know, there's really, if there's movement and things are getting done and they schedule dates, or it would be great if it actually got done then, but I don't see that happening, right? But, you know, you could have a whole change of tone. But if we keep getting this obstinate stonewalling where they're delaying and not making any progress and, you know, nitpicking on stuff that's not the issue, you know, it's going to head in that direction and it's going to hurt everybody. You know, I mean, I don't want to go on strike.
Nobody
I got
does.
To do. I want to teach. I want to do research. I want to help these students graduate. But, you know, there comes a point where you got to stand up for what's right.
You know, as I've always heard, there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat.
You're right.
And here we are.
Yep.
So if this were to happen, I don't want you to give inside baseball stuff. Are you looking at, you know, during the school year? Are you looking at the summer?
You know, I mean, if February 1st goes poorly, you never know when a strike could happen, but it puts it a hell of a lot closer. And if it's going to happen, I assure you, it'll be before summer.
Well, I hope that if anything, I hope it doesn't happen first and foremost. Because having been on strike a couple of times in my life, not the perfect outcome.
No, it's not. It forever damages relationships. I mean, it's not nobody wins. Right, but you got to stand up and say enough is enough.
Yep. But if it does come to that, we want you to come back and talk to us and keep us informed in the loop. I appreciate it.
Not a problem.
Dr. Quinn, thanks so much. Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, Palm, on demand, and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Given his own cool reserve and his first-term penchant for pursuing a tepid middle-right governing agenda, I didn't expect to get much warmth from Barack Obama's inaugural address. I was surprised. In his speech, the re-elected president actually showed some FDR jut-jawed presidential flair. Rooting his address in America's solid progressive values, he issued a call for the great majority of our people, the middle class and the poor, to join him in a nationwide campaign to rebuild our country's infrastructure, our ladder of upward mobility, and, most importantly, our sense of shared purpose. Predictably, right-wing pundits and defenders of the corporate order decried his speech as partisan and socialist. But in fact, the best word to characterize the speech is simply American. It was a straightforward restatement of the grassroots principles that the founders first articulated. It's no accident that his most used phrase 5 times was, "We the people," the opening words of the remarkably progressive preamble to our nation's founding document. We the people still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity, Obama reminded us. We do not believe that in this country, freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not stop our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. This is Jim Hightower saying, at this difficult juncture in America's long and uncertain journey toward egalitarianism, when powerful forces of elitism are trying to push our society down the dark alley of plutocracy, this was the speech we needed. Read it for yourself at www.whitehouse.gov/blog/inaugural address.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state. We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
Detroit. city town. Here in the real world, they're shutting Detroit down.
Yes, today, the fourth anniversary of the release of that song. John Rich, country singer, songwriter, you know, talking about auto workers. You know, where are those songs? You know, I remember as a kid, there were a number of songs about the plight of actual working people. You know, this being one of them. And, you know, you go, man, you know, you look at all the money that we have heaped on the very wealthy. You look at all of the tax breaks that we've given the huge corporations who have abdicated their responsibility, walked away. It's just amazing. And, you know, and good for him for writing the song. I'm not a huge country music fan, but, you know, that one touches a nerve because you look at what we've done and you look at what we're doing. You look at what we're doing to this country. And today, for instance, the budget secretary, Charles Zogby, was at the Pennsylvania Press Club luncheon here in Harrisburg. And, you know, basically saying, well, you know, if we don't do pension reform, if we don't do it, it don't mean that we'll have to go back into the general fund, you know, to find savings. And that'll mean cuts, you know, cuts to education, cuts to granny. So what we're doing, what he's already saying is, what we're going to do is we're going to divide you up. We're going to divide and conquer. You people who want education, well, you're going to have to give up granny. Or you're going to have to give up those workers' pensions, which are probably your pensions. If you want to save any one of those, someone goes out of the boat except the wealthy people. We have chained the wealthy. We've chained them to the boat. And he pointed out that the state will have a pension obligation, his number, somewhere around $511 million to fund the pension funds. And he says, look, you know, Zogby says, if we don't find the savings there, well, should other areas bear the brunt of those savings? Should that fall into public education? Came across some interesting numbers from the Corbett years. He's been governor now 2 years. He's given away $400 million in business tax breaks because of the federal depreciation, the bonus depreciation rules. He's given away another $355 million to corporations through reducing the corporate stock and franchise tax. He has handed another $175 million away with the Educational Improvement Tax Credit. Gotta love that. And, you know, another $45 million in a whole plethora of other special, like the one, one of my favorites, for a handful of companies. You will be able to keep your workers' state tax. And we don't know, we the taxpayers don't know where that money went. We don't know who got it. And we don't know what they used it for. It could be for giant ice sculptures who, you know, urinate out vodka like Kozlowski. Could be that. So you think about it, just do the quick math, because, you know, I went to basic school. That's about $975 million over 2 years. He's talking about $511 million. They gave away $975 million over the last 2 years. And let's not forget the billions of dollars that vanish through that laundering process in that little magical box there in Delaware. Let's not forget about that, because they've done nothing to close that up. And you go and you look at this stuff and you go, at some point, when are we going to wake up to the reality that the people who are running this state, this country into the ground, are the very people who keep saying, oh, we believe in family values. Yet the only value I see is putting money in the pockets of the very, very wealthy. And mark my word, if you see the pension deal that I hear is coming down, if you hear that go through, because there are some people who go, well, we got a $41 billion liability, which is true. If everybody retired today, all at once, I think Paul Quinn alluded to that. If everybody stopped right today, everybody stopped working, everything stopped, everybody said, give me my money now, that would be $41 billion. Mark my word. And this is where the lack of thought by the Republicans, the lack of understanding how government and society works, and this pure obsession with ideology is going to destroy our government and destroy our state, but that's their intent. That's the goal. That's mission accomplished. That they can roll out the Bush banner for that, and you know, the little pouch and the pants and everything. Because when they do that, then it's, hey, we did it. But understand, if we do what they're advocating, there is going to be a mass exodus of teachers and state workers and people in that pension fund. And it's going to make the situation much, much worse. Because if they change the component where people are saying, hey, you're going to stop me from taking my lump sum out, I'm taking it and going, you're going to see a draining of the pension funds at a time when we could least afford it. Because the fund desperately needs that money to stay put until the economy picks up so the fund can recuperate some of the massive losses thanks to the business-friendly recession. Remember during the Bush years, all the business-friendly policies we pushed during the Clinton and Bush years? Oh, you know, we just deregulate. Go back to all this deregulate. Oh, it's wonderful. Just deregulate. They'll never crash the economy. They learned their lesson. And what'd we end up with? So here we are. We're looking at the same scenario. They are advocating for something that is going to make things worse. They know it's going to make things worse. I sat in on their pension hearing. Their expert said, look, if you go to a 401k style system, it is going to be more costly. And you're going to bankrupt the fund. They sat there and they heard it is going to cost taxpayers considerably more, and yet they're still going to do it. They still want the, or we're going to sell the next generation down the road. Which, understand, by selling the next generation down the road screws the generation ahead of us. Because that big pot of money, nobody's putting anything else into it. There's a problem. Which is what's going on with pension funds across the country, is that we've allowed business-friendly mentality to dwindle the number of people in this country who have a retirement, who have some security in old age. We've allowed them, because understand, the state wants to do what big corporations have been allowed to get away with. They want to run the state through bankruptcy. They want to go through bankruptcy, do away with all those legacy costs, like we've allowed the Romney corporations to do and all of these hedge fund groups to get away with. Yeah, hey, you know, just run that company into the ground, saddle it with a massive amount of debt, and then take those pension obligations, that health care obligation, into bankruptcy court and let the judge just write it off. Because, by the way, our right-wing corporate friends, they put in their judge. Because their judge is the guy who's going to make sure that, well, we can't tax them. We can't tax those corporate people. I mean, aren't you sick of it yet? I mean, it is so blatant. It is so transparent. It is so right under your nose. The stench has got to gag you. And what we allow these people to get away with is just mind-blowing. And what's amazing to me is they're very transparent about it. You get Rick Snyder there in Michigan saying, well, that whole right-to-work thing, that's never about anything. That doesn't matter. And just, you know, with the message of, just sit down and relax. Not a big deal. It is a big deal. And if it was Joe Biden, I'd throw in the other word, but I can't. Because it is that big a deal. Stealing the future of my children is that big a deal. Privatizing a public service, that big of a deal. Quick break, right back after this. You want to hear about a big deal? Stick around. You want to hear this.
Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, a 1,000-year-old Buddhist statue, now believed to have been carved from a meteorite.
The statue is known as Iron Man. A Nazi-backed expedition to Tibet shipped it back to Germany shortly before World War II. Scientists from Germany and Austria have now used chemical analysis to conclude that this statue is carved from a piece of the Chinga iron meteorite, which fell near the border of Siberia and Mongolia around 15,000 years ago.
Gold prospectors in 1913 officially discovered the Chinga meteorite, but the statue is much older, perhaps 1,000 years old. It's 24 centimeters, less than 10 inches high. It weighs 10.6 kilograms, almost 24 pounds. In other words, it's heavy because it's made of iron.
The science team conducted an analysis of the iron, nickel, cobalt, and trace elements of a sample from the Buddhist Iron Man statue. They found that its geochemistry matches values known from fragments of the Chinga meteorite.
If the statue is in fact made from this meteorite, the piece turned into the Iron Man statue would be the third largest fragment of the meteorite known. These scientists published their study of the Iron Man statue in the journal Meteoritics and Planetary Science. To see a picture and find out more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Iron Man. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
And I think it's going to be awakening to us because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we've put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education, like, better into the schools.
Inequality I just ignored. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
It still blows my mind that woman is an elected official serving in our state legislature. It just blows my mind that how you can stand there with a straight face and say, you know what, the governor didn't actually cut $2 billion from public education. No. He took it out, but then he put it back. And you go, well, where is it? Well, it's not there. Those are 20,000 education professionals across the street of the state that we kicked to the street. Don't look behind the curtain. No. And this week, School Choice Week. You got to love that. I love the right-wing vernacular. I love the whole, you know, we love charter schools, even though we saw a report this week that, well, they aren't as good as they keep telling us. I guess if you're the one who's making the criteria of what success is, then, yeah, pretty successful. But if you had to go by the standards that everybody else goes by, evidently not so good. In fact, none of the cyber charters made any real progress, did not make AYP, and the vast majority of the brick-and-mortar charter schools, not so much. They didn't do well either. So, hey, a lot of money gone down the drain. But what we are seeing is this drain of resource from the public school to these charter schools and all of these startup ideas with a big, nice profit motive at the end, is we're seeing the consolidation of public schools. We're seeing the closure of public schools, not just here in Pennsylvania, but across the country. And I love this frame of school choice, which is why I've asked Sidonie Williams, who is a mother of two young boys who attend the Samuel Gompers Elementary School there in Philadelphia, a school that the SRC, the School Reform Commission, wants to close down and consolidate with another school. The other school just happens to be on one of the most dangerous schools around. Not a good idea. So much for choice. Sidonie, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, how are you, Rick?
I've got to be honest, probably a little bit better than you, because if I were you, I would be flaming mad. This idea that I moved into a neighborhood where there was a school in my neighborhood, it was a good, decent, safe school, and now the SRC wants to take my kids and send them to one of the most dangerous schools in the city. Sorry, I'd be fuming mad.
Actually, I am fuming mad. I'm trying to be very polite since I'm on a radio show, so...
No, I mean, I'll be honest with you. If you know, I moved into a neighborhood, so much, never mind the property value that would just sink into the toilet because the school that you wanted to buy into is no longer that school anymore.
Absolutely.
But the safety of my kids.
Yes. So, you know, we as parents, we have 378 students at Gompers Elementary, and we are all serious. We are extremely upset. We actually launched a campaign 3 weeks ago, an aggressive campaign to fight against this. We did a protest rally on Martin Luther King Day. We had about 300 people came out to the rally. So far, we collected over 2,000 signatures. We actually had our councilman Curtis Jones Jr. went on camera and pretty much says, you know, he endorsed Gompers staying open, and he also endorsed the moratorium. And then the very next day at the SRC community forum meeting, he came, asked for our petition, and signed our petition.
Well, I mean, you got to do something because it's the will of the people, because I'm looking at this and it makes really no sense to me. I understand. I think I would understand if you take the kids from the more dangerous school and you move them to the less dangerous, to the safe school. I get that. I don't understand why you would take kids from the safe school, move them to the dangerous school. Has anyone asked the SRC this? Because for me as a parent, I would go, I understand bringing the kids from the dangerous school. I get that. But the other way around makes no sense to me.
Yes, I agree. We have asked. We've sent out formal letters. We've asked at community meetings. We've asked at small group meetings. The only thing that Dr. Hyde, the only answer he ever provided to us was, it was just, he looked at the three facilities and Beaver, with the capacity that Beaver can hold, it makes the most sense. I don't think that the SRC took the children's safety or their academic success into consideration at all when they make this decision.
Or your choice, because it is, after all, Sedania, it is School Choice Week, and I guess you made your choice. They're just telling you no.
Yes.
You know, I look at this, and when I saw the name of the school, I'm a labor guy. I'm a big fan of organized labor because I know what it's done for my life. But it's interesting to me that Samuel Gompers is the school that they're closing. And part of me said, you know, is this an ideological thing? Because Samuel Gompers, obviously the founder of the American Federation of Labor, an iconic labor figure of our past. It seems to me, just being someone who's keenly aware of this stuff, that could be a motive as well.
There's many rumors, it has been circulating. Samuel Gompers sits on St. Joseph University campus.
Uh-huh.
We have heard, we don't have any solid evidence, but we have heard that the School District of Philadelphia did offer, Gompers building to St. Joseph. But St. Joseph, were not satisfied with the price that the school district was asking for, so they decided that they will not purchase the building at this particular time because the price at this particular time is not the right price. So these are the rumors that have been circulating, and I think that one of the big motivation for closing down Gompers is also, it's a prime property. It's in a great location. St. Joseph is expanding, it's huge now, and acquiring Gompers really would make a lot of sense for St. Joe.
Yeah, so if we lower the value, then maybe they'll buy it cheaper. Because that seems to be the way we do things here in the Commonwealth. Our governor seems to do the same dumb, wrong-headed things by, you know, devaluing things so we could sell it off cheaper.
It seems like that, Rick. It really does.
So what do you say to parents, you know, around the state who go, you know what, well, that's just Philadelphia. You know, that's not my neighborhood school. That's not my kid. I shouldn't worry about that.
But you know what? That's not the attitude that we're receiving from parents, whether or not it is their school that is slated to be closed. We, you know, in the last 3 weeks, we have met with thousands and thousands of other families, students, teachers from across the city. We're all pretty much trying, you know, we're all pretty much calling for a one-year moratorium. And with every, you know, whenever we have our meetings, we go to all the council meetings, we go to all the community meetings, we kind of crash all the private SRC meeting, and we're telling the SRC the same message. We're all calling, every single parent, teachers and students from across Philadelphia are all calling for that one-year moratorium.
And I think that's the place where you start, because you look at the facts, and you know, facts don't seem, they don't lie. At these charter schools, they're just not cutting it. And look, I know people are saying, well, the charter schools are public kind of schools, they're publicly funded. You know, it's just that you don't have the school district running them. I want somebody running them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, see, with charters... Charter school is a bit inclusive because not every single student get chosen to go to charter school. Charter school to me is a bit similar to private school. You have to go through this application process,
right,
if not a lottery process. And let's be honest, Rick, these charter schools pretty much have the opportunity to cherry pick their students.
And they're still not making the grade.
And they're, yes, exactly. They're still not making AYP. Exactly. I mean, I don't know, if we decide to go the charter school route, we would leave many, 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 many students and families behind.
And what's frustrating to me is that the moneyed interest, and I guess my grandparents' generation got it because they lived through the Depression. When the money speaks, be weary, because there's a reason that the money is speaking, because they see more money. And for me, it's perfectly clear that the destruction of public education in this state and across the country is purely one for profit and two for control.
Absolutely agree. I agree with you 100%. I absolutely agree with you.
So what do we do here? Because I've been saying what's going on and why I think it's important that people in our listening area hear what's going on in Philadelphia and hear what's going on at the Samuel Gompers Elementary School down there is because when they're done perfecting their model in your neck of the woods,
mm-hmm,
they're coming here.
Yes. Yes, Rick. You are absolutely right. Yes. If you live outside of Philadelphia, if you live in Marion or if you live in Delaware Township, you would think, well, it doesn't affect me. This is just something that's happening in Philadelphia, because 52% of Philadelphia public school children are from African-American background or from low-income families. So because I live in the suburb, it's not going to affect me. But, Rick, you are so right. I don't know how true that is. I don't know. Once they finish with Philadelphia, they may move into the suburb. We don't know.
Well, we do know, because it's there's money to be made in it. And where there's money to be made in it, where they can suck the future out of my kids, they're going to do it for the quick buck. Sidani, I appreciate the time. As your fight continues, I'd love to know where this takes us, because, again, this makes no sense to me, why you would move kids from a safe school to one listed as perpetually dangerous makes no sense.
I agree.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we violate. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that the federal court decision in Washington, D.C. by a panel of Republican judges overturning President Obama's appointments for NLRB board members is nothing less than shocking. Trumka says in a radical and unprecedented decision, that court panel interpreted the Constitution in such a way as to deprive presidents of both major parties of a critical tool that they have used hundreds of times over the years, the recess appointment.
Obama had appointed NLRB members during a congressional recess, but Republicans used a parliamentary trick to technically stay in session to block Obama's appointments. Trumka says the AFL-CIO strongly disagrees with his court decision and expects it to be reversed on appeal. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says her union also strongly disagrees with the decision, and she says SEIU is confident that these National Labor Relations Board appointments will be upheld as the appeals process moves forward. On Tuesday, the Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan, or MAFAN, will gather for an event supporting Nissan workers who want a union at the plant in Canton, Mississippi. Activist Danny Glover will join clergy, elected officials, the Mississippi Student Justice Alliance, and civil rights leaders in the rally to support union organizing at Nissan. As President Obama prepares to move forward on immigration reform, SEIU says that a new national poll shows a solid majority of American voters back immigration reform that includes a path to earned citizenship. The poll, sponsored by SEIU, America's Voice Education Fund, and National Immigration Forum, was conducted by Public Opinion Strategies, that's a Republican polling firm, and Hart Research Associates, a Democratic firm. 4 out of 5 voters in that poll said they support a system that requires immigrants to pay taxes, holds employers accountable for hiring legal workers, and prevents them from exploiting immigrant labor. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has until the end of today to sign legislation that would raise the state's minimum wage and provide an annual cost of living increase. The New Jersey AFL-CIO is urging the governor to sign the bill. The Labor Federation says it believes raising the minimum and providing cost of living adjustments will help not only low-income workers, but also as a first step toward combating growing economic inequality. The AFL-CIO says if Christie doesn't sign it, the Labor Federation will aggressively pursue a constitutional amendment to get it done.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW, the OPEIU, and the National Association of Letter Carriers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, at the end of the week, we're going to be in Thursday and Friday for the Families USA Healthcare Conference. And one of the things that always sticks out at me, we talk about how do we get, people healthcare? You know, and it's a conversation we have to have. But the conversation we don't quite get all the time is, what about the people who are providing the healthcare? What about when they don't have healthcare? What about the people who are caring for our sick, caring for our injured, caring for the folks who need it when they themselves are uninsured and don't have that in return? Well, I saw this situation out in Washington, Pennsylvania, where workers there are going, you know what? We'd like to have some say in the quality of the care that we give, and also we'd like to make a decent wage with some health care benefits. And I saw that the hospital is saying that the workers who work at the dietary and housekeeping departments, they're going to take over a $4 an hour pay cut. Again, I go back to when you've got bean counters who are in charge of running hospitals, whose first thought is, how many beans am I going to get? Not how well are we taking care of people, and not what we're doing for the community. We got a problem, which is why I've asked Sally Burdine. She's a housekeeper there at Washington Hospital. I understand today they voted to go on strike here in the future. Sally, thanks for taking time for me.
Yes, we, the workers, you know, we aren't real happy about a strike, but the administrative staff decided that we won't do anything. We'll just accept anything they've given us because we have given concessions in the past years. You know, they took our pension last contract. We took a wage freeze the last contract on the first year. Now this time they're just, you know, a wage freeze.
just flat out trying to steal back everything that you've fought over the years for and then some.
Yes, and, you know, they're wanting to give us a $400 deductible the first year of the contract, up to a $1,500 in the third year of the contract. It's just, I mean, ridiculous that, and then, like you said, they want to take $4 an hour wage cut on us. You know, we'll be working to pay health care if we can afford to. I mean, and that's all we'll be doing. We won't be able to get, you know, I mean, pay your mortgage or drive a decent vehicle. It's just, you know, then you've got your CEO up there making over $300,000 a year. It's just ridiculous. And, I mean, they want to talk that they want to be the employer of choice. It's going to be a revolving door. Right now, we've got employees that are 42-year employee. You know, 42 years this man's been there. Longevity was always a sticking point for the hospital. They were always proud of the fact that the employees came and stayed. That's because there was something worth coming and staying for.
Yeah, you had an experienced workforce and people who knew how to care for people and knew how to perform their duties. You know, but I don't think that the people running hospitals today really care much about that. I firmly believe our healthcare system is so badly broken because you've got not doctors and healthcare experts running hospitals, but accountants and MBAs.
That's very true. I mean, it's no longer is it a, you know, patient care is your major focus. It's on the money's being brought in, even though we are supposed to be a community hospital run by and for the community and the biggest employer in the area. Now we're going to become a minimum wage employer that is cutting staff and now cutting benefits and, you know, they don't even want to recognize seniority anymore. They want you to work on a merit thing. And, you know, it's just, I mean, there's really nothing at the Washington Hospital that's going to be worth coming for if they continue in the vein that they're going with asking for all the recessions from the workers. You know, and we've got a couple of hundred years of service in the bargaining committee.
Yeah, and people care. I mean, people who care about their jobs and love the work they do and want just a little bit of dignity, a little bit of respect. There's nothing wrong with that stuff.
Yeah, that's all we're asking for. You know, a fair wage for a fair day's pay. I mean, it's just constant something that the union started out at Washington Hospital for. You know, I mean, they had to strike two times in the past to get to where they are today. And like you say, we've never been afraid of giving a concession if the hospital was in a strait that needed it,
yep,
to help them out. But to just give back because of greed, no.
No, I think that's how we all are, though, Sally. I think, you know, when times are tough, we as Americans, we roll up our sleeves, you know, we'll share in the sacrifice. And I use the word share because we want everybody to share. I mean, you're talking about a $4 an hour pay cut. That's a massive portion, I'm sure, of what you earn. Is the CEO taking an equally massive share of his pay being cut out, and the executives and the folks at the top, are they taking that kind of a cut as well?
No, and that's what I said. You know, here they are. He's got 8 vice presidents at this hospital, and I can almost bet they make at least $175,000 to $200,000 a year. Now, why couldn't we cut 4 of them? And we could leave the housekeepers and dietary and make a decent minimum wage, you know, wage to live on instead of we take the cuts, we take the deductibles, and are they going to have the same $400 deductible out of their $300,000 or $200,000 pay that I'm going to get for a $9 an hour job?
See, that's what we need to be asking more of. Why, okay, fine, you're going to make me pay $400, but let's make that in proportion to your income and mine and let you pay out, make it $200,000. Then you're going to pay a $50,000 deductible or you're going to pay a $20,000 deductible.
Right. That's what, you know, that's what I said. Let's look at their increases over the last 10 years compared to mine. In the last 10 years, we have went backwards because when I was hired, we paid no copay. We paid nothing to park there. You know, now they're taking, you're paying to park the copay. I already pay $200 a month to pay on my insurance. Now they want to add $400 deductible on top of that. Then they want to add an increase to my copay for medications. They want, I mean, to take my clothing allowance And trust me, the clothing allowance doesn't even buy half the time your shoes, because you have to have safety shoes that are non-skid. You know, and it's just a constant give, give, give.
Yep.
On our part, the worker.
And the thing is, Sally, is you're not the only one. There are millions of workers in this country that are in the same position. The difference is the vast majority of them don't have the ability that you guys are doing, saying, you know what, we're not going to take it anymore. There's only so much of you-know-what we're going to eat, and we're going to stand, and we're going to fight, and we're going to demand that we get a little bit of respect. And I give you credit for it. And, you know, as I look at this, I think there has to be a resurgence in what you're doing. Workers are doing, going on strike and taking to the streets, because that's the only way we're going to keep decent wages and health care and retirement plans in place. That's the only way I see forward.
That's the only way. It's got to be, because you've got young workers coming in to jobs that people have fought for and made them what they are today, and they don't realize the history behind getting to where you are. You know, and then you've got the bosses up there saying, hey, we can do this because we are in charge. And the people are like, well, I can't afford to strike. Well, there isn't a person out there that can afford a strike.
Yep. You can't afford not to.
Exactly. You can't afford to just go to work and say, hey, okay, I'm going to come to work, and maybe by the end of the day or month, I'll owe you money for my health care because I'm part-time. I can't afford that deductible, but by God, I got to have a job. Well, you know what? People fought. People died to get where we are today with the unions, and you've got to keep them strong and keep them moving.
No, I'm right there with you. You know, I look at this, and you said, you know, over $4 an hour in pay cut to the people who are working in dietary and housekeeping. You know, the people who actually do a function there at the hospital I'd spent a couple of weeks over the summer in you know, different hospitals, and the people that were the hardest working folks there were the people at the bottom of the pay scale, the people who were cleaning up the mess, the people who were bringing the meals, and the nurses' aides, and those folks who were the ones who were doing the direct patient stuff, the people that I saw every day. Those are the people who were doing the real hard work and who were doing the work that the hospital needed to do, and cutting their pay and cutting their benefits just makes no sense to me on any level.
No, because like you say, that is the direct patient care. You start cutting down at the bottom, you're cutting the cleanliness, the quality of the foods, the, you know, preparations, the deliveries, the nursing assistants. I mean, they've got some of our nursing assistants running from between floors. You know, they'll short staff them. They'll say, well, you can have the day off because our census is low. The next thing you know, that person's at home. They've had people admitted. Now, well, you've got to run up and downstairs because we've got short staffing today, but you know, tomorrow we're going to make you pay double what you're paying on your health insurance, and we're going to cut wages, and we're going to cut this. And that's the thanks you get for being a good employee.
So now where do you go from here? I understand you had the vote today. The majority of folks voted yes. We're willing to go out on strike. We've got to move this forward, even if it's just saying, you know, we're going to go on strike to use as a stick to get the hospital to the table and negotiating. What's the next step from here?
Tomorrow we meet with the hospital again. The next day we meet, and we also have a rally down at the Alpine Club in Washington. And any unions that want to come out, support, we are more than happy to see. We'll be down there at 4 p.m. And then our expiration date is the 31st. Hopefully we'll come to some kind of an agreement that is livable for all people, and if not, then we'll have to continue hopefully negotiating until we send them what days or what times, whenever we'll be either walking out or going back to work, whatever, you know, resolution we
right.
come to.
Last line of questioning I've got for you, because the community, you said it is a community hospital, and I would have to assume, you know, people like me, I look at the folks doing those jobs in those hospitals with the utmost respect and say, those are the people who really make the hospital, you know, having been in three local hospitals. I look at them and I say, you know, those are the people who are the real, the bloodline of that hospital. Are you reaching out to the community, people like me in your community, who say, you know what, you are that bloodline, you are the life of that, and you should have some respect? And what kind of response are you getting from them?
I think we've just started reaching out to them. Tomorrow we're going to hit WJPA in Washington, the local radio station, And we have been trying to get a hold of the local representatives and stuff. And with the rally, it'll hit the news and, you know, really inform everybody. But I believe we're a pretty union-oriented community. I mean, it's, you know, Cool Town Steel Mills. This is what Washington, Pennsylvania was built on,
yep.
Pittsburgh, Washington. And I still think even though the steel mills may not be here, we still got coal mines and we still got a lot of union history here.
And you know, to be honest, a lot of people who know that that's the path to the middle class. Sally, I appreciate the time. I wish you nothing but the best of luck. And as this moves forward, we'd love to have you come back on and inform us on where this is going.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Sally. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
To the Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Given his own cool reserve and his first-term penchant for pursuing a tepid middle-right governing agenda, I didn't expect to get much warmth from Barack Obama's inaugural address. I was surprised. In his speech, the re-elected president actually showed some FDR jut-jawed presidential flair. Rooting his address in America's solid progressive values, he issued a call for the great majority of our people, the middle class and the poor, to join him in a nationwide campaign to rebuild our country's infrastructure, our ladder of upward mobility, and, most importantly, our sense of shared purpose. Predictably, right-wing pundits and defenders of the corporate order decried his speech as partisan and socialist. But in fact, the best word to characterize the speech is simply American. It was a straightforward restatement of the grassroots principles the founders first articulated. It's no accident that his most used phrase 5 times was, "We the people," the opening words of the remarkably progressive preamble to our nation's founding document. We the people still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity, Obama reminded us. We do not believe that in this country, freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. This is Jim Hightower saying, at this difficult juncture in America's long and uncertain journey toward egalitarianism, when powerful forces of elitism are trying to push our society down the dark alley of plutocracy, this was the speech we needed. Read it for yourself at www.whitehouse.gov/blog/inaugural address.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for tax shelters. Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts,
and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
You know what cuts will never happen? You know what cuts and redundancy will never, you know what will never go away? CEO pay. The very wealthy. The payments to the top, never going to get cut. And the redundancy of all these tax breaks and all these handouts, never going to go away. It's only, you know, cutting people at the bottom. It's only doing away with that redundancy when it has anything to do with taking from folks at the very bottom. And I look at this, what will be our quote of the day from Christine Lagarde. And she was, if you remember, she was the replacement for Wolfie, Paul Wolfowitz. And Wolfie would have never said this. Understand, Bush's boy Wolfie would have never said this in her piece, Cut Bankers Pay or Risk Another Crash, which was published on the 24th in The Independent. She says excessive inequality is corrosive to growth. It is corrosive to society. Christine Lagarde said, I believe that the economics profession and the policy community have downplayed inequality for too long. Yeah, because they're on the payroll. Christine, I think you're not going to be having this job very long if you keep talking like this. Because understand, who funds them? Very wealthy. And you see this release from the Dallas Federal Reserve. From the data from the Federal Reserve there, 12 banks, 12 big institutions, you know, the too big to fail folks, they held near 69% of the industry assets, almost 70% of all of the industry assets, all the banking money. Now understand, there are about 5,600 commercial banking organizations in the U.S. You know, most of them community type banks, you know, small, the kind that I think we need to have more of. About 5,500 are these community banks assets, you know, less than $10 billion, you know, focused on, you know, doing the business of banking, being very prudent, weren't the ones who got into an awful lot of trouble in 2008, seem to remember that. The 12 who control almost 70% of the industry assets, they're the ones who seem to get into a lot of trouble because it was never enough. And if you need the percentage, it was 0.2% of all banks. 0.2% control almost 70% of the industry's assets. And you go, well, how's that compared to 2008? Well, that number has actually gone down. Because what we've done is we've made too big to fail, too big to fail. Because we've allowed them to consolidate more assets and become even greater mega banks. And now these 12, they fall into that category somewhere between $250 billion in assets and $2.3 trillion. And you go, you know, did anybody back during the collapse say anything about breaking these 12 up? Oh, yeah, me and a lot of other people. Because understand, the vast majority of banks, you know, like the 99.8%, they didn't seem to get into trouble, did they? Because they actually tried to follow the rules, tried to do the right thing. And, oh, by the way, actually could be regulated because they weren't so powerful and so all-encompassing to be able to impose their will on regulators. You know, just kind of a thought. Maybe we should be breaking too big to fail up so that we can keep an eye on them. Just a thought. And if one fails, you allow the free market to do what it does. See, I'm very much a capitalist in that vein. Do what you got to do. Some people are allowed to fail. Some people are do a little bit better. But at the end of the day, I'm not into monopoly. Sorry, not happening. What we've created, though, is this banking cartel who has held us hostage. And then they fund little puppet leaders, you know, people like Grover Norquist, who evidently, according to U.S. News and World Report, evidently is now going to Italy. If you look at the last election, a lot of people have walked away from his pledge. A number of folks that, you know, he pushed for, they lost. So he's got to take his dog and pony show somewhere. I guess Italy, the perfect place. And according to U.S. News and World Report, a group called Tea Party Italia. Do I need to go into the whole Tea Party, you know, thing? Not being Italian? Never mind. But anyway, inspired by the Tea Party movement in the U.S. and by Norquist's pledge, Tea Party Italia created a similar taxpayer contract pushing ahead of its country's general election. The pledge says politicians won't raise taxes and will reduce the country's debt. And, you know, if any place you go, Europe, these countries in Europe understand exactly what austerity has brought them, which is more pain, more suffering, more spiraling down, more unemployment, more debt. And we just talked about it last week. They actually were cutting spending, more pain, more suffering, cutting social programs, cutting to the bone. Unemployment actually went up, and guess what else happened? Their debt actually went up because there's no one paying on it. No one has a job. So when I look at this stuff coming home and I go, you know, austerity, it doesn't work. We've seen it. We've seen it played out. No. The billionaire class doesn't see it that way. It's worked very well for them. Because they've been able to buy a lot of assets really cheap. So you see in Italy, now, you know, you've got the conservatives, not just in Italy, but in, you know, countries from Japan to Israel, doing the same kind of things, flaming up these fake AstroTurf kind of groups with a lot of money. And filling the coffers of a couple of politicians to give them some credence, pushing this ideology of austerity. And there's part of me that goes, at some point, we have got to say no more, right? I mean, I look here where, you know, Zogby had his little luncheon today, saying, here are your choices. These are your choices, folks. These are, Tina, there's no alternative. It's education or it's those workers' pensions. It's education or it's granny. It's those pensions or it's granny. Or we've got this over here. We can sell this asset. We can sell the wine and spirit shops. We can sell the lottery. We can sell all these things off. But not talking about what we really should be doing, which is closing the Delaware loophole, first and foremost. I mean, we've lost, in the 2 years that Corbett's been governor, almost $1 billion. That could solve some of our problems. You think of the environmental degradation that we've legislated to allow to happen. We're not taxing that really either. I mean, at least pay for the mess you're going to make. Not doing that. You know, I had one of my wife's relatives spent the weekend with us, and she teaches, you know, up in the area where they're drilling. And she says, you know, our school district has been decimated by funding cuts. And we've got an influx of English as a second language students coming in, and they're in and out, so you can't even plan. There's a boom-bust mentality going on. The roads are getting torn up. The resources are overtaxed, underfunded. And who's getting rich off of it? Well, people who've never been to Pennsylvania. Granted, the workers come in, they make a little bit of money, and they leave. And behind, they leave a whole bunch of problems. Because we're encouraging not only the boom bust, of which we should know better. Pennsylvania has a history. Think about the coal industry. We've got a history. We understand it. We understand natural resource rape. We get it. Do you think we learn any lessons from it? And if we haven't, what's wrong with us? I mean, I go back to the coal mining era. Those were not good-paying jobs. Those were not family-sustaining jobs. Those were not decent wage jobs until workers organized, until the unions made them that way. Yet here we are, looking again, same scenario, transient labor coming through. No organizations going on yet, because you got a governor who's, well, you know, he's willing to sign right to work if it comes. I'm telling you, folks, it's going to take us in the streets. But the moneyed class, they're going to spend. then spend to keep us down. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, a 1,000-year-old Buddhist statue, now believed to have been carved from a meteorite.
The statue is known as Iron Man. A Nazi-backed expedition to Tibet shipped it back to Germany shortly before World War II. Scientists from Germany and Austria have now used chemical analysis to conclude that this statue is carved from a piece of the Chinga Iron meteorite, which fell near the border of Siberia and Mongolia around 15,000 years ago.
Gold prospectors in 1913 officially discovered the Chinga meteorite, but the statue is much older, perhaps 1,000 years old. It's 24 centimeters, less than 10 inches high. It weighs 10.6 kilograms, almost 24 pounds. In other words, it's heavy because it's made of iron.
The science team conducted an analysis of the iron, nickel, cobalt, and trace elements of a sample from the Buddhist Iron Man statue. They found that its geochemistry matches values known from fragments of the Chinga meteorite.
If the statue is in fact made from this meteorite, the piece turned into the Iron Man statue would be the third largest fragment of the meteorite known. These scientists published their study of the Iron Man statue in the journal Meteoritics and Planetary Science. To see a picture and find out more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Iron Man. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, in a right-to-work state, at a low cost, with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Yeah, let those people learn the lesson the hard way. Especially if they're working people. Not like those banks that had to learn the hard way. Remember, the banks, you know, we need to save them, right? Because, you know, they're vital. They're important. Unlike those workers. What we want to do there is we want to steal their pensions and take away their health care and cut their wages in half. That's the American dream right there. Blows my mind. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. I saw this quote. Chief lobbyist for the Kansas Chamber of Commerce. Yes, what I call the terrorist organization at the Chamber of Commerce. A guy named Eric Stafford says, while testifying on to a committee meeting there in Kansas about this piece of legislation, to say, well, you know, we're not taking dues money out of those workers' paychecks because, you know, just like the legislation we've got here in Pennsylvania, because they should have freedom and options, blah, blah, blah. You know, the BS line. He blurted out just, you know, the truth, and you got to give him credit. At least he was honest. He said, I need this bill passed so we can get rid of public sector unions. And that, all of the open workforce initiative, all of the no rights at work agenda, all of that, that's what it's about. Cut to the bottom bone, cut to the end of the road, that's it. Nothing else. Nothing about freedom, nothing about, oh, we care. Nonsense. It's about Machiavellian policy and destroying you and me and destroying our rights and our ability to get to the middle class, which is why I've asked Mike Marvin, executive director of the Kansas Organization of State Employees, Local 300, to come talk to us about Mr. Lobbyist's statement. Mike, thanks for taking time for me.
Yeah, no problem, no problem. Let me clarify, though, this wasn't our dues, this was our COPE political money.
Okay, so we've got a guy who's got the same legislation that says that the state, the employer is not going to take money out of the checks for one for dues, one for political PAC money. There's a whole bunch of them. This is just for the political end of it, right?
Yes, yes. There are some serious restrictions that we will lose our dues check off if we violate the law, though.
Okay, so let me ask you this. His statement. He needs this bill passed to get rid of the public sector union. I don't know how much clearer he can be.
Oh, clearly, that's their goal. That's their national goal. They're coming at us hard everywhere. That is the end result that they want. And I was dumbfounded that they were able, that he openly stated that in a public forum in front of a legislative body.
Was it a matter of him just being, you know, frustrated? And it just, you know, one of those spontaneous moments of truth where you go, "Oh, I'm sorry, I said that."
I think so. One of our few Democratic senators on that committee was pushing him pretty hard and questioning him pretty hard, and I think he was getting frustrated and just blurted it out.
Yeah, I mean, they don't pay all that money in political campaign money to have to be pushed like that, I would assume.
You're right. You're right. They just don't expect it. They expected everybody on this committee pretty much to be friendly to him. We're outnumbered, conservatives to progressives, dramatically. I think we only had four, progressives on this committee, and it was just, we're outgunned.
But I look at it, and it's not, you know, not even the conservative progressive angle. It's the insanity to the rest of us angle. I mean, here in Pennsylvania, we've got some crazy kooky people who've got some insane ideas of, hey, we want to take your right away. We don't believe in the government stepping in between anything, but we're going to use the government to step between you and your employer. What sense does that make?
It makes no sense whatsoever to a reasonable person. What it simply is they're trying to silence our voice, our ability to speak out for our members to organize and to support legislation, candidates that support workers. They want to kill our ability to do that.
I mean, this has nothing to do with, and to me it's very clear, this is Machiavellian policy at its best. We're going to take our political enemies into the public square, and we are going to gut them in public so that anybody who will ever dare to oppose our rule again, they'll meet the same fate, and they won't even try. That's what it says to me.
It pretty much says that. It intimidates people. That is the reason behind a lot of it, I believe. Shut up and listen to what Master says and do it.
Yeah. I mean, as I said, Kansas is a right-to-work state already. How much more watered down can they, and how many more obstacles can they put in the way of workers to have their actual right to organize?
Well, they have several others out there right now. They have a bill out there that goes to our public relations board that certifies bargaining units, here's unfair labor practice cases, they're watering that down and their ability, they're going to make it more expensive for the locals to use that, to find fact finding, mediation, those types of things. They have that bill out there.
Yeah.
They also have another bill out there that gets what, teachers can bargain for.
All the things that we're not just seeing in Kansas, but seeing in places like Michigan and Wisconsin and here in Pennsylvania, because it is. It's a national strategy put out by folks like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Americans for Prosperity, and all of these other euphemistically named groups who we care about that poor little worker person. Nonsense. Come on, Mike. We know better than that, right?
Absolutely, we know better than that. What is interesting on this bill is that the chamber is really pushing this bill, the state chamber. The president of the state chamber is the former speaker of the Kansas legislature who tried to push this bill through 3 years ago and couldn't get it.
Wow.
And now he's back again, and he's using the muscle of the chamber. He has strong ties to Americans for Prosperity, and, you know, here in the home of Koch Industries, AFP and the chamber, they do their bidding.
Yeah, strongly tied to their pocketbooks is what you're telling me.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I look at this, and I have to wonder, do the working people of Kansas, did they see this? I mean, at some point we have to... You know, I go back to my grandfather's generation, and my grandfather always said, if a rich guy's going to take a buck out of his pocket to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. And, you know,
he's a wise man.
And, you know, the reality is the older I get, the more he was right. The more money I see the Koch spend, the more money I see the DeVos's spend trying to destroy education, the more money I see going after privatizing our public assets, the more I go, man, you and me and working people, we're getting the screws, and there's nobody really advocating for us because they're destroying the only people who do.
They do. You know, they are destroying the only people who do care about us, and it's been they've progressed with this. They saw, I think, years ago that a bunch of working class people, I know a lot of my department roads guys, you get out there and you stop them on the road and talk to them or anything, they've got, you know, that damn Rush Limbaugh on the radio they're listening to.
Yep.
This agenda has progressed, and they've convinced workers down the line that they have their best interests at heart, so not as many are speaking out. I believe that we're starting to wake up, that people are starting to see what the end game is. And our people are making a lot of calls to the Capitol right now. I think it's having an effect. I hope it's having an effect. I hope it wakes some people up that we are looking now and we're watching what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset, Mike, and you know, if you're not on board with my train of thought, you know, you have the freedom to say so. But I'm of the mindset that things have to get much, much worse before you're going to shake people awake to get them out in the streets like we did in the past. You know, I look at the Great Recession that cost millions of people their jobs, millions of people their homes, and you don't see the folks in the streets like we saw the pictures of the Depression. And I think a lot of that was structural. You had, you know, the business-minded people who said we got to get rid of those unemployment offices because that's where people go to congregate. We got to get rid of the welfare offices because that's where people go. They've done a masterful job of dividing us up and pushing the less fortunate and the misfortunate to the corners and to the periphery.
Yes, they have. Yes, they have. And I am pretty much on board with where you're at. We've got to get back, but we probably will get back to that point with the soup kitchens and the soup lines and people fighting for work and before we truly, truly wake the American masses up. That was told to me, I'll bet you, 20 years ago by one of my mentors. And I've seen that, and that's probably where it is headed.
And it's, you know, you go and I read so much of the history and I remember, and I guess it's because my mother worked in a nursing home, when I was a kid, and I spoke to a lot of the old timers who they lived the majority of their life through that rough period and that growing period out of the Depression. So I got to hear their stories and at a very young age understand the pain and the suffering of people like me. And I don't want my kids to have to go through that, Mike.
Neither do I. You know, I really don't. But sometimes, you know, things have to get bad before people wake up.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that it doesn't get that bad, but sometimes you need a slap in the face.
So do you think this statement is going to wake anyone up there in Kansas? I mean, is this playing there? Do people see it for what it is?
I think that our membership is truly seeing it for what it is. You know, we're doing daily emails out to our people. We're hearing that the phone lines are jammed at the Capitol, that they're getting a lot of calls, not only from us, but from the general public. We're putting out as much as we can, that, you know, this is not the democratic process. This is not Kansas values. You're trying to exclude a whole class of people from participating in the political process.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
Silence their voice.
Yeah, but here's the thing, Mike. We saw the exact same MO in Wisconsin. We saw the exact same thing in Ohio, but they had the ability to push back in Ohio. Saw the same thing in Michigan, and we're seeing the same thing in Kansas, same thing in Pennsylvania. It is the authoritarian rule of the right.
It is. It really is.
And I'm hoping that we wake up and say, you know what, this is not, you know, we keep talking about, oh, it's the party of Lincoln and Eisenhower. Nonsense! It's nowhere near Eisenhower or Lincoln.
You know, let's talk about Teddy Roosevelt.
Yep.
You know, that's who they should be looking at and what he did, breaking up the monopolies, and we're growing monopolies now. You know, the chicken in every pot, everything. Roosevelt understood, Theodore Roosevelt
right.
understood,
Teddy.
Which... It's surprising to many people.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, it's how our history has been told, not just the U.S. history, but also the history of labor that hasn't been told. And when it is, it's told wrong.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. People should read Labor's Untold Story. Very good book.
Yeah. I recommend it highly. But the reason I asked you on is because the fight that you're going through right now, it's coming home to roost here, and people need to know what this is all about. And I appreciate you taking a little bit of time for me for the fight out there and to inform us. And I hope to hear how things go in the future, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you want me on, I'll be more than happy.
I appreciate it, Mike Marvin. Thanks so much, Executive Director of Kansas Organization of State Employees, Local 300. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. From the top.
Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the world.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/Visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pseccu.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
It came out, you know, earlier during the news segment at the top of the hour, talked about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. There was hope that he was going to sign the minimum wage increase, which would have increased the minimum wage all the way up to $8.50 an hour over the next 3 years. And then it would have tied minimum wage increases to inflation. So we wouldn't have this period where the minimum wage gets eaten away, gets eroded by inflation. So he, the good governor that he is, the good business-friendly, pro-right-wing governor, Chris Christie, used what is known as a conditional veto, which means he sent it back to the legislature saying, well, I'll sign it, maybe think about it if you do a couple of things. Over the next 3 years, it's not going to be $8.50. I'm going to cheat those people out of a quarter down to $8.25. And that whole thing about tying to inflation, not going to happen. Not going to do it. And you go, well, hold on a second. You know, stop and think about this for a second. Why would you go through this when you know that the wages would have increased, somewhere in the $440 million range in the first year, which would have been more money pumped into your local economy? Why would you be against that? I mean, you think about the economic activity that would be increased in that first year, hundreds of millions of dollars, could create, couple thousand jobs. Seems reasonable. Because, understand, what the right says, it's going to cost jobs, never has come to fruition. It's a nice talking point. On a common sense level, if all you're thinking about is this employer's going to have to pay a little bit more money, he's going to have to rethink that hiring, you go, it makes sense, plausible. Doesn't happen. Not happening, because you have more people with money buying products and you have more economic activity. Makes sense, right? More money in the economy, more people serving the needs of that economy. Perfect sense to me. And the other part, it's only high school kids, right? It's only high school kids. Well, according to reports, it would have helped almost 540,000 people who live in New Jersey. These are the folks who make between $7.25 and $8.50. That many people. But now you start to look at, and look, here's why, and I'm going to let you in on a little secret. It's pretty simple. Chris Christie didn't refuse to sign this bill because it's going to raise the minimum wage on the lowest income people in the state. That's not the reason. He could care less about that. He understands that once you raise that minimum wage, that floor from 7.25 up to $8.50, that guy who's now making $8.50 will then demand $9.50. And the person who's making $9.50 is going to want $10.50. And that guy who's going to want $10.50 is going to want a little bit more. And all the way up the economic chain, people are going to go, well, wait a minute. They got a raise. Why aren't we? All the way up. And understand what's going on in this country. They're stealing back wages. All of these companies are going, no, there's opportunity to steal back health care, we can take pensions away, and oh, the wages, yes, take that away. Vacation, cut that away, sick day, cut that away, yes. All this stuff we can take back. We should have a crisis every couple of years. That's the reason. If you now turn this around and signal that, you know what, we're going to raise the wages of the people at the bottom, everybody above them is going to go, hey, what about us? And that, my friends, that is exactly what the business-friendly people do not want. They don't want American workers going, hey, wait a minute. We would like to make a living. We're tired of sacrificing. They don't want that. They want American workers scared to death that tomorrow they're going to lose their job, and the meager wages and the what little benefits are left will then be gone as well. And then feeding us this line of bull going, well, you know, we need to pass right-to-work laws because they're not great jobs. With knowing that there are no rights in right-to-work, and there's surely no work. And now we're using a doctored-up report by some front group? Come on. We know better than this. Don't we? Got a couple emails during the break caught my attention. Andy points out that there were amendments to Dodd-Frank to break up the big banks. Senators Merkley and Kaufman and Senators Levy and Brown had amendments to break up the big banks when they hit a certain asset and deposit percentage. Both were shot down by Blue Dog corporate Democrats, according to Andy, especially Wall Streeters like Chuck Schumer, Robert Menendez, and Frank Lautenberg, along with the entire Republican Senate contingency. And he's right. There were some minor talks of it. But again, the well-heeled business friendly folks, they were not going to consider it because, hey, that's campaign coffer money. I got another, speaking of the bank, got an email asking me how badly do you want to punch Lloyd Blankenfein in his smug face, particularly, when this 0.5 percenter says we have to lower our expectations. Lower our expectations to what? Cheaper brand of cat food? Good point. And Ron points out that, asked me if I follow what's going on in North Carolina. And a little bit, Ron, I do. I did know that the governor there, as Ron points out, one of the first things that the Republican governor did there was raise the salaries of his top aides. And as Ron points out, somewhere from $120,000 up to $135,000. And according to Ron, his reason was that they needed extra income so that they could afford to live while running a multi-million dollar state agency. Which, you know, hey, what about the people who actually do the work? Well, screw them. Ron also points out the first thing on the legislative agenda is to lower the top rate of unemployment compensation from about $500 a week down to $350 and shorten the period from 26 to a sliding 12 to 20 week, which we've talked about in the past. Had a couple people on talking about that. But understand, as Ron points out, vote for Republicans, this is what you're going to get. He also says that there's talk afoot about getting rid of corporate taxes, which we talked about last week, and the income tax and instituting a state sales tax on food and services. Again, you know, this is the right-wing view. Tax the people at the bottom. Let them pay all of the taxes and let the very wealthy walk away because they have the ability to evade by going to other countries or to other states. Smart policy, right? Not so much. Going to take a quick break right back with hour three of the program. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that the federal court decision in Washington, D.C. by a panel of Republican judges overturning President Obama's appointments for NLRB board members is nothing less than shocking. Trumka says in a radical and unprecedented decision, that court panel interpreted the Constitution in such a way as to deprive presidents of both major parties of a critical tool that they have used hundreds of times over the years, the recess appointment. Obama had appointed NLRB members during a congressional recess, but Republicans used a parliamentary trick to technically stay in session to block Obama's appointments. Trumka says the AFL-CIO strongly disagrees with this court decision and expects it to be reversed on appeal. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says her union also strongly disagrees with the decision, and she says SEIU is confident that these National Labor Relations Board appointments will be upheld as the appeals process moves forward. On Tuesday, the Mississippi Alliance for Fairness at Nissan, or MAFAN, will gather for an event supporting Nissan workers who want a union at the plant in Canton, Mississippi. Activist Danny Glover will join clergy, elected officials, the Mississippi Student Justice Alliance, and civil rights leaders in the rally to support union organizing at Nissan. As President Obama prepares to move forward on immigration reform, SEIU says that a new national poll shows a solid majority of American voters back immigration reform that includes a path to earned citizenship. The poll, sponsored by SEIU, America's Voice Education Fund, and National Immigration Forum, was conducted by Public Opinion Strategies, that's a Republican polling firm, and Hart Research Associates, a Democratic firm. 4 out of 5 voters in that poll said they support a system that requires immigrants to pay taxes, holds employers accountable for hiring legal workers, and prevents them from exploiting immigrant labor. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has until the end of today to sign legislation that would raise the state's minimum wage and provide an annual cost of living increase. The New Jersey AFL-CIO is urging the governor to sign the bill. The Labor Federation says it believes raising the minimum and providing cost of living adjustments will help not only low-income workers, but also as a first step toward combating growing economic inequality. The AFL-CIO says if Christie doesn't sign it, the Labor Federation will aggressively pursue a constitutional amendment to get it done.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW, the OPEIU, and the National Association of Letter Carriers.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're not going to let people do school reform in the name of school reform in a way that makes the schools bad. Us educators have a real stake in that.
What, professionals wanting to take care of their profession, wanting to make sure that their craft is well tended to, that... You know, I had an interesting conversation this weekend with a friend who's a teacher, and he said, you know what drives him insane? People who know nothing about education telling him how to educate children. He spent his entire life studying and mastering his abilities only to have some politician or some pundit come and say, well, this is the way it should be done without actually having a clue. And you look what's been rammed down our throats. All of this standardized testing, all of this high-stakes testing, where you don't even get the results for months into the future, which is why I think this whole national opt-out campaign is a step in the right direction. We need to relocalize education and take it back from the federal level where the money has taken over. And as you know, this is National School Choice Week. Charter school or cyber charter or basically just another ripoff of the taxpayer and their children week. And I guess, you know, along the lines of going to get me edumacated at the local mixed school. The sad reality is we've allowed this to go on for too long and we've got to stop. And Pennsylvania has become the wild west of charter schools. So when I see folks around the country doing things that I think are important, I think it's important that we take a look at it and, you know, maybe jump on board, which is why I've asked Wayne Au, professor at the University of Washington, also the editor of Rethinking Schools, rethinkingschools.org, his website, to come talk to us. Wayne, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, sorry.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, something deep right then. So tell me, I didn't catch the first part of your question.
I didn't have a question yet. I just said okay. Thanks. I appreciate the time, man.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
You know, I look at this national opt-out campaign, and I've been telling folks in my parents of friends of my kids that, you know, this is something we should be looking at. And I noticed that you have signed on to this national campaign to opt out of the current obsession with standardized testing. Why?
Oh, you know, there's a couple reasons. Mostly, I think high-stakes standardized testing is really ruining public education right now. It's putting a stranglehold on the curriculum. It's forcing teachers just to teach these very narrow focus on specific kinds of science and language arts. Of math and language arts instruction. And you know, we're seeing really important things. Like the arts and humanities and even PE and social studies being just completely left out of the curriculum in some places because it's not adding to the test scores. And so that's one of the many reasons that I think high-stakes standardized tests are really being detrimental and bad for public education. The other thing, if I can jump in and add, is that it's sort of a backdoor way of privatization of public education because yep. What we're seeing is a lot of our public money being used to pay for Pearson and the textbook publishing companies, all the test prep materials and the people processing the data, all that's private industry. And so it's another sort of way for private money to sort of feed, for our public money to sort of feed into private industry.
Yeah, I mean, I look at there was a company called Ignite. They were one of these testing companies headed up by Neil Bush. I seem to remember his brother was kind of president, signed some law that put these standardized tests into place.
Yeah, not only that, the Bush family is very close friends with the McGraw family of McGraw-Hill Publishers, who have made a fair amount of money on textbooks and test prep materials as well.
And then you throw in the other brother, Jeb, who is one of the privatization darlings, with his little group, pushing the destruction of public education and this whole push towards charters and all of this privatization nonsense.
Oh, absolutely. Jeb's a real big advocate for fully online digital schooling and these models of public education where you have these privately run charter schools and these huge classrooms with 40 or 50 students at computers with one sort of proctor or somebody, and that's the teaching. He's a real big push behind the online education movement.
Yeah, I've got a problem with the whole online education, especially for K-12. You want to get into higher education, we could talk about the use of that and if it's worthless or not. But, you know, those primary years where you're learning, basic things. My producer sent me a picture because it is, the charter week or school choice week. He sent me a kid of a picture with that says, why it gives him flexibility to be going to these cyber charter schools. And there he's got two screens. The one where he's, doing the classwork and the other one where he's probably cheating.
Right. Yeah, I just have to say, honestly, I hadn't been keeping track of, whatever this is, National School Choice Week. And when I heard about it, I had to laugh because talk about manufacturing, a corporate every form event. I mean, National School Choice Week, that's outrageous. And the biggest irony for me is I feel like that these conservatives, these corporate education reformers are really using this language of choice. Everyone wants a choice to, again, just sort of set up for the failure of public education to really push against public education and take all of our taxpayer money and channel it right into either, charter schools that aren't being run by a public institution or right into private schools. I mean, a lot of these school choice people are all about private school vouchers using public dollars for private school education.
Yeah, and sadly, the only choice that really comes out of it is the very wealthy get to decide, do I want a second yacht or a second vacation home?
Right. And the other thing that's really crazy about it is what choice ends up meaning is fundamentally having public money, but without the public accountability. And so we're just seeing, a lot of these, a lot of private schools, a lot of charter schools not serving students with special needs. There's been all sorts of corruption and tons of scandals around, CEOs of these nonprofits who are running charter schools, being charged with embezzlement and misuse of funds all these ethics violations. It's a whole bunch of deregulation.
Yep.
It's a chance for people to get access to this big pot of public education money. and not really have any public accountability or really any real public oversight over how they're using our money.
Yeah, but Wayne, they went to jail and they're sorry and they'll be punished. but we're not talking about all the kids that they screwed over and the future of those children that they stole.
Oh, I know. I mean that's the worst thing about it is they're essentially running this game out on our kids. You know, and even when it comes to, we're just going to close the bad charter schools or we're going to close the bad schools. I'm like, man, you're talking about taking kids whose lives may already have a certain amount of, like, instability, and then you're going to close their school, and that's supposed to help them?
Well, I mean, just a little bit earlier.
And you're making money off of it? You know, I mean, that's crazy.
Just a little earlier in the show, I talked to a woman who lives in a fairly middle-class neighborhood there in Philadelphia. They are closing the neighborhood school in her fairly middle-class area, and they are going to consolidate the school where her kids go, that's a fairly safe school, into one of the most dangerous schools in the city of Philadelphia.
Man, wow.
And you take that to the frame of school choice. She chose the safer school. They are now going to make her two kids go to one of the most dangerous schools in the city of Philadelphia.
You know, and fundamentally, you know, like, everyone should have the choice, the quote-unquote choice for a safe school. But to me, I'm like, okay, why can't we choose to do enough restructuring and invest in public education so that all of our schools are safe? And so that it doesn't have to be, you know, for this parent having to sort of negotiate, you know, whether or not her kid gets to the safe school. Because what about the kids who didn't have the choice and are going to the school where that isn't safe and there's violence? That shouldn't be on them. Like, we need to have a public education system where the only choice is a safe school. But that's about us investing in public education and doing, you know, really, really strong community-based development. You know?
And that's the part that we don't want to do. We want the silver bullet. We want the quick solution. We want it simple and easy because there's always got to be a political answer, and it's got to be very simple. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. There were no simple answers in that community. And the school districts in that area struggled because you had all of the poverty issues. You had the broken homes. You had all of the parents who couldn't pass the tests that their fifth or sixth grade kids were having to pass. So how do you expect the kids to move ahead?
Yeah, you know, honestly, we have every single bit of research backs up your statement right there. You know, we know that if we're looking at test scores, the most overriding factor are a series of things that are outside of schools, whether it's homelessness, whether it's food security.
Hunger. Stop with the food. With the academic numbo jump. It's hunger.
Sorry. Well, it's hunger, yes. You know, access to health care, consistent health care, early childhood education, just all these things, you know. I mean, homelessness, right? And we know that all these things really, really impact how kids do in school. Duh. But, you know, instead of dealing with those issues, you know, we get all these people working with data and policy and politics saying, we're going to forget all that stuff, and we're just going to blame it all on teachers, and we're going to blame it all on schools.
See, because doing all that hard work that you just laid out there, that doesn't fit on a bumper sticker.
Yeah, and it takes serious social reform that has to be about equity, and obviously the powers that be aren't really interested in seeing that, I think.
And then you got to start talking about real jobs plans and real public policy to do all of the things that haven't been done for low-income communities, which the wealth class, they don't want either. They want cheap labor, exploitable labor, but they also want a class of people that you can look back at and go, well, at least I'm not them.
Yeah, and honestly, they want that class of people to be well-trained, which is why the high-stakes standardized test is promoting really sort of lockstep curriculum, and you know, it's sort of, in a way, it's sort of creating people who become good at following directions and taking orders, not about making sort of empowered decisions about their lives.
Yeah, you know, here in this state, I don't know what's going on out in Washington, but here in Pennsylvania, they're talking a lot about education should be, you know, that just like job training, you know, it's, we're going to tailor our education system for a certain segment of jobs. And for me, I'm against the idea of this whole job-tailored education, because what happens when the job that you've been tailored to do disappears? Once they've decided they can outsource it, what do you then do?
Yeah, I mean, not only can the jobs disappear, but really, I don't believe them when they say that, because I don't, you know, if that's the case, then they really, really want a lot of our kids to be undereducated. Because I don't think the jobs fully exist for what they claim they want them for, right?
Excellent point.
You know, that's one of the biggest contradictions in this whole discussion around educating kids for jobs. Our economy is not set up in a way where there's a livable wage for all kinds of work. And so I'm just not convinced that you know, these folks really want kids to be educated for high paying and stable, hopefully unionized jobs, because our economy isn't set up to support that right now.
So how do we fix the education system? Because, you know, I grew up at a time where the silver bullet was busing. We took poor kids from one side of town, shipped them to another side of town with equally poor, equally crumbling schools that lacked the resources. It's just we shuffled them around. Now we're shuffling the schools around. None of it works from an educator standpoint. You know, what do we do? What do parents do? Because I want my kids to get the best education, and I know other parents do too.
Yeah, I think you asked me this last time you had me on. And, you know, my answer is still the same. You know, fundamentally, I think we have a regressive tax structure, and I think we need to level out the playing field in schools and society and the economy, and we need the rich to be taxed more because those resources could go directly into both to the schools themselves and into supporting the development of the communities around the schools, because all those things have to come at once if we're going to be successful at fixing education. Fixing education means fixing society. And so we need programs that will help people be gainfully employed, and we need social services. We need all that stuff to help students do well in school.
And remember the question, because if you ever come back, I'll probably ask it again, because that was a perfect answer.
All right, thanks.
Wayne, I appreciate the time. It was great talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
All right, go away now. Assistant professor at the University of Washington, also the editor of RethinkingSchools.org. Great publication. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
America for the better.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Given his own cool reserve and his first-term penchant for pursuing a tepid middle-right governing agenda, I didn't expect to get much warmth from Barack Obama's inaugural address. I was surprised. In his speech, the re-elected president actually showed some FDR jut-jawed presidential flair. Rooting his address in America's solid progressive values, he issued a call for the great majority of our people, the middle class and the poor, to join him in a nationwide campaign to rebuild our country's infrastructure, our ladder of upward mobility, and, most importantly, our sense of shared purpose. Predictably, right-wing pundits and defenders of the corporate order decried his speech as partisan and socialist. But in fact, the best word to characterize the speech is simply American. It was a straightforward restatement of the grassroots principles that the founders first articulated. It's no accident that his most used phrase 5 times was, "We the people," the opening words of the remarkably progressive preamble to our nation's founding document. We the people still believe that every citizen deserves a basic measure of security and dignity, Obama reminded us. We do not believe that in this country, freedom is reserved for the lucky or happiness for the few. The commitments we make to each other through Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, these things do not sap our initiative. They strengthen us. They do not make us a nation of takers. They free us to take the risks that make this country great. This is Jim Hightower saying, at this difficult juncture in America's long and uncertain journey toward egalitarianism, When powerful forces of elitism are trying to push our society down the dark alley of plutocracy, this was the speech we needed. Read it for yourself at www.whitehouse.gov/blog/inaugural address.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Choke a few someone to turn around. Herman Cain. He's done it before, he can do it again. This train's coming to town like a hurricane. Herman Cain. Get on board. Get on board. The Hurricane Train.
Yeah, get on board. Yeah. Cain Train. I miss Herman. What's he doing? I guess he took over a talk radio program somewhere, I guess. I haven't heard anything about it. But, you know, you look at him and you go, I wanted him to be president. He would have been comical. You know, every bill, according to him, should be no longer than 2, maybe 3 pages long, which shows you the depth of his thinking. Everything had to be very simple. You know, so we would have big, complex issues, 2 pages. Could read it over dinner. Sounds interesting, but, you know, could you actually run anything like that? And the answer is no. But if you remember, and you got to love his 999 plan, which is actually a 909 plan, 9% sales tax, 9% tax on you and me, and 0% tax there in the middle on corporations. Because eventually, because, you know, there was a whole bunch of loopholes in there for that. You look at it, that's the right-wing view. No taxes on corporations. No, let the wealthy walk away from paying their taxes and make sure you stick it to the people at the bottom. The very bottom. You know, those 47% who don't pay any federal income tax, we're going to raise their taxes from nothing to 9%. So you're talking about a 9% increase. That was the Cain plan, pretty simple stuff. And then sales tax, jump that up to 9%. Federal tax, that's on top of your state tax. Who does that hurt? Well, it hurts people at the bottom. It hurts people like you and me. And that's the point. I mean, it's pretty simple. That's the point. Now, anything that benefits you, me, not going to fly. They're going to destroy it. And I look at this, all of this nonsense over. Now, look, I'm not a huge fan of Obamacare. There's some things in it I think are smart. There's some things that were done, I think, with the right intention. But that's because I've always, you know, unapologetic for it. I truly believe a Medicare for all system was the way to go. Open that up. And it didn't even have to be, you don't even have to make it, you have to buy Medicaid or Medicare. It's an option. Affix a price to it and get subsidies to people so that they can buy into it. It's a pretty simple idea, simple concept, which is kind of what people are arguing Obamacare really is. Well, we're going to have all the private companies come in, they're going to give their plans, and you'll be able to choose from a series of plans, and you'll be able to pick out which one you can afford and what you want. Kind of like a very simple website there, figure stuff out. Kind of like the eBay, if you will, of healthcare. And there'll be some little subsidies in there to help you out. What I find interesting is I saw this House Bill 649 in Texas, introduced by a representative down there, a Republican named Jonathan Strickland, who believes that, you know, we should be subsidizing corporations. And especially those companies that decide that, well, they got a moral, religious obligation against that their contraception thing. In particular, the Hobby Lobby, which, you know, evidently their CEO seems to have this religious problem. And I wonder how many employees at the Hobby Lobby actually have health care. And I've been thinking about this, you know, for some time now. You know, these people who say, I have a religious, moral conscience problem about, you know, those workers getting contraceptive care. I wonder how many of those people get health care. they don't have a moral conscience problem with not providing them health care when they could, when it's perfectly something that they could do. They don't have a moral problem with that. But if that health care has something to do with contraception, well, no. But anyway, this House Bill 649 would, if, and I guess it's been crafted, you know, for the Hobby Lobby and folks like them, this tax break that they're going to give in Texas, according to this bill, if you as an employer decide, I've got a moral problem, I'm not going to pay it, and then the fine will come, because the federal government will then fine you for not providing health care for your employees. And whatever that is, based on, you know, what the calculation is, the state will reimburse you in a tax break. I'm not making this up. So if you, and I'm starting to think, well, how many people are just going to claim moral, like, I got a moral problem with it, just so they don't have to pay it? And then the question becomes, and I guess it's that whole equal eyes of the law thing, what about the companies that do provide it? What about the companies that do pay the fine or whatever? Are they, is it not somehow unconstitutional to go after one and not the other? Or to give something to one and not the other? But that doesn't matter. Not at all. It just blows my mind, to be honest with you. Interesting story last week, if you remember, Phil Mickelson, the seventh wealthiest athlete in the world. Said that he pays upwards of 63% tax because Obama and Jerry Brown have raised taxes in the U.S. and in California, and he might just leave. Well, quickly after the firestorm brewed, because people don't like to look at a guy who's worth, you know, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars and say, hear them whining. Turns out, if you go and you look at it, the most he should be paying, according to the tax justice people, somewhere in the 30% range, with any reasonable accountant, somewhere in the 30% range. Now, the question then became, the question that these folks asked at the Citizens for Tax Justice, who made him walk backwards? Because right away, Mickelson stepped away and said, finances and taxes are a personal matter. I shouldn't have made my opinion public. He said, I apologize for those I've upset. You mean the bankers and the ExxonMobil's and the pharmaceutical company that you hawk the drugs for? You mean those people who don't want it brought up that they're not paying their taxes? I mean, what's amazing to me is this whole conversation around Mickelson anyway has been, we shouldn't be taxing the very, very wealthy and 62% is really high. No, because we're not taxing them at that rate. It's not even close. We should be talking about these big companies who, like the pharmaceutical companies, like the big oil companies, how they've walked away from this nation. And I saw a story over the weekend. You know, Tina Turner evidently is now a Swiss citizen. She renounced her American citizenship. And while I don't know why, the tax thing seems to be kind of convenient. I mean, the timing kind of makes you go, is it the tax thing? You know, she's made hundreds of millions of dollars in this country. Is that the patriotic thing to do? Because we love to thump our chest when it works out for us, but the question is... So the question I have is, what do we do with these folks then? Because we've had a couple of them. The guy from Facebook ran off somewhere. Tina Turner's run off. And I'm sure there's a couple others. What was her name? Rich. Her husband is the one that Bill Clinton pardoned on the last day. The songwriter, I forget what her name was, Denise Rich, I think. She's left the country because of the tax issue. And you go, should they ever be allowed back? And You know, what does it say? You know, I look at the woman who's now the head of the IMF, who's saying, you know what, we need to be cutting the pay of these big bankers. We need to be cutting the pay of the ultra wealthy. We need what Krugman called the Great Compression again. We need people to live in the same communities. And I, you know, I look at the story of the woman who, you know, we talked to earlier. You know, they bought a house and they live in the neighborhood where, you know, they thought that's the school I'm going to send my kids to. School's good, pretty good school, doesn't, you know, safe, you know, has a pretty good reputation. That's where we're going to put down our roots. And now all of a sudden they're saying, well, you know what? We're going to send your kid over here to a school that's perpetually listed on a list of the most dangerous in the state. A, what about your kids? B, what about any investment you've made in your property? You bought a house thinking this is my school, and it ends up being this one over here. Your property value just plummeted. And that's a conversation we've had yet to have when we talk about schools. When we're pushing for all of these charter du jour school of the day, man, what's that going to do to your school values? When we allow what's going on in Philadelphia to come here in Harrisburg or and any other community, what's that going to do to your property values? Not good. And, you know, I just scratch my head at all of these very, very wealthy people who have made tens and hundreds of millions of dollars off the backs of their workers, off of the infrastructure that generations of past have provided, off of tax breaks that we've allotted them, and then they turn their back, not only on their workforce, but on the nation. I look at this guy from Papa John's. Back during the campaign, boy, he was the poster child for Mitt Romney. Oh, I'd have to raise my price of pizza it'd have to be 11.25 cents if I was going to have to provide health care. Now we find out, according to CNN, he was lying about the whole thing. It was BS. They ran the numbers, wouldn't cost him a dime. But, you know, what do facts matter? You know, but I go back to my grandparents' generation. I mean, here is a guy who has made his fortune off of the backs of a low-wage workforce. And I've been saying what we need to do is we need to raise that low-wage workforce up to a reasonable-wage workforce. Would that make Papa John less wealthy? Maybe a little, but not that much. Would he still live in a palatial estate with a golf course and the big couple of swimming pools and all of the... Probably. Because, you know, those workers that made him that fortune, they would have some money in their pocket. And they, in turn, may actually buy a couple more pizzas, which would give him more to work from. Something seriously wrong with the way we look at things in this country. Or the way I shouldn't even say the way we look at it. The way things are repeatedly displayed to us. Because we're all too busy to think this, to think at every bit of messaging that comes our way. We're too busy staying on the treadmill trying to figure out, hey, how do we take care of our own family? How do we make sure that my kids are in a safe school? How do we make sure that they've got a future? How do we make sure that my paycheck makes it the next paycheck? That, oh, I hope the kids don't get sick because I can't afford a deductible. I understand. But we've got to stop. We've got to stop this insanity and stop this nonsense that's being shoved down our throats by the right wing of this country. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
Majority. Rick Smith.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
The most important issue today is which Monopoly piece is going to go? Who gets the boot in Monopoly? Is it the car? Is it the thimble? Do we get rid of the thimble? How about the boot or the dog? Maybe one of that. Maybe the battleship. I don't know. The top hat, which I don't know. The top hat, I think, has to stay. That's kind of the sign of the wealth class. Also, maybe the iron or maybe the wheelbarrow. Locally, the wheelbarrow has some significance because evidently there's a plant over on Cameron Street here in Camp Hill. They make 80% of all of the wheelbarrows sold in the country. Made in the USA, 80% of them. To me, that's almost a monopoly, so that should be almost what stays, right? And you think of, wheelbarrow, your wheelbarrow full of cash to the bank. I kind of get the monopoly thing. Sad reality is odds makers are saying it's about 2-to-1 odds that the wheelbarrow will be the one seeing the curb. They're proposing a couple other ones. You can vote on this. You could, a cat, not a big fan of the cat, but you could also go with the diamond ring. Maybe the guitar. I'm not quite sure about that. Or the helicopter. You can fly from, private place to private place. And finally, the toy robot, the other choice to replace one of the other ones. Hoping it's not the wheelbarrow. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. I got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, what do you think? The wheelbarrow, should the wheelbarrow stay or go?
Keep the wheelbarrow. This supports the workers.
I'm with you, but you know what? This is the game of Monopoly. Monopoly is about the very, very wealthy. It's about, the extraordinarily wealthy. Those worker tools, they don't want to see that stuff. They want to be like Mitt Romney. They want to push a couple of buttons, a screen, and sandwiches appear. It's amazing.
Awful, awful. Well, I think they should keep the wheelbarrow. They should keep the iron. They should keep the thimble.
You're pro-thimble as well. So what goes? Maybe the battleship? Because, here's the thing. I can see the reason for the battleship because that's how the wealth class keeps their money.
Yes, and the men, feel, shall we say, empowered when they move a battleship around the board, shall I put it politely.
So then I guess you're going to go with the Scotty dog, get rid of that and replace it with the cat.
I always play with the dog and the cat.
Well, there is no cat. They're talking about replacing it with a cat.
I play with the Scotty.
Okay, see, so you're not pro get rid of the Scotty and bring in the cat?
No, I keep the Scotty, but I have to say it's actually a game that I refuse to play. I don't approve of the game.
My kids, we've never played it. I think we have it somewhere, never actually played it with them.
I think it brings out people's very worst instincts.
Yeah. I agree. And it perpetuates that whole, if I'm just lucky enough and I don't, if I land on, if I get Boardwalk and Pike Place, I can be like them.
Yeah.
And you're right. I agree. We could be like them. So what's going on? I see the big news, some immigration news.
Yes, immigration news is going forward on two parallel paths. First of all, a bipartisan group of senators today announced that they have reached a deal on a blueprint. A blueprint, you could call it a set of principles, a framework, call it what you like, but it's a plan It's got four main pillars: border enforcement, employer enforcement, the handling of the flow of legal immigration, including temporary agricultural workers and high-skilled engineers, and a pathway to citizenship for those who entered the nation illegally.
Right, and they have to go home, if I understand. All of them have to leave and then come back. Is that part of it?
No.
No, I thought that was. Maybe that was just someone wishing and hoping.
Yeah, I've not seen that. Anyway, they don't have to go home.
Chips? Are we chipping any of these people? Because we need to know where they are. We need really big, tall fences, lots of people with guns on the borders, and, of course, RFID chips.
Drones.
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 In fact, a drone for every person we let in.
We might get drones on the border as part of the security piece.
Nice. Nice, because we need to, we need to build, militarize our border. I'm okay, good, good. That means jobs.
That.
We need a bunch of people flying the little planes around.
Well, actually, what's quite interesting about this proposal is that not every category of immigrants is treated exactly the same, and I'm looking for my language here, but different categories. Most categories are treated exactly the same, but children are treated slightly differently, and agricultural workers are treated slightly differently.
Slightly differently how? A little more liberal, letting a little more of them in?
Better.
Okay.
It says individuals who've been working without legal status in the United States agricultural industry have been performing very important and difficult work to maintain America's food supply while earning subsistence wages. Due to the utmost importance in our nation maintaining the safety of our food supply, agricultural workers who commit to the long-term stability of our nation's agricultural industries will be treated differently than the rest of the undocumented population.
How differently? Will they be given the right to organize and maybe collect a little bit better wage so they can exist in our society without having to be second-class citizens hiding in nooks and crannies?
That I don't know the answer to.
No. Because I would assume, the low-wage worker, they're going to bring in by the drove so they can drop the bottom of the labor pool out and keep us continually divided by saying, look, it's those people who came in. It's their fault. It's the immigrants' fault.
Oh, that's cynical.
Well, but it's what we've done, Victoria.
Yeah, it really is.
It is what it is. I hate the fact of it, but it's what they've done.
Yeah.
What about the children? I mean, because you want to bring the children in young, so you can maybe make engineers.
Well, what's happened with the children? It's individuals who entered the children as minor children did not knowingly choose to violate any immigration laws. Consequently, under our proposal, these individuals will not face the same requirements as other individuals in order to earn a path to citizenship.
Okay. Any penalties, any fines, any regression,
yes.
Any beatings, something?
Yes, there are fines and back taxes for people that they have to pay before they get sent to the back of the line.
Okay, so let me ask you this, before they get sent to the back of the line. So when they pay their fines and they pay their fees and they pay all that stuff because of back taxes they supposedly didn't pay, will their employers be subject to paying the same things, and will their employers have to pay all the Social Security and unemployment and workers' comp and all that stuff that they didn't pay? Just curious.
That's a very interesting question, one to which I do not know the answer.
Oh, I can tell you what the answer is. No, because this is a very, very pro-business country we live in.
Yes.
We're definitely not going to be going after the businesses.
Probably not, and it probably would be very complex.
And in fact, talking about going after the businesses, I saw an interesting note you sent me about the Treasury approving excessive pay for the people that we bailed out.
Oh, this is really interesting. Yeah, the Special Inspector General for the Troubled Asset Relief Program says that the Treasury Department approved all 18 requests it received for executive raises at AIG, General Motors, and Ally Financial, Inc. Of those requests, 14 were for $100,000 or more. One raise for the CEO of a division of AIG was for $1 million. Now, the three firms together received nearly $250 billion from the bailout fund, and only AIG has fully repaid it. And the report says the Treasury bypassed rules under the 2008 bailout that limited pay. Further, Treasury approved raises that exceeded pay limits and, in some cases, failed to link pay compensation to performances.
Well, that's our boy Timmy.
And well, he didn't do it, actually. It was somebody else who did it.
It's under his watch. It's his people. It's his department. Am I wrong?
It was. It was under his watch, and he's gone.
Yeah, and do you think Mr. Liu will do any differently? Because, I mean, at the end of this...
He asked questions at his hearing.
Yeah, at the end of this, you know, you go, are you surprised by the fact that, you know, we're going to continue to hand out tons of money to the people who did what they did, and they're people who just seem to go in and out of government, back and forth to Wall Street, back and forth to regulatory over... Are we surprised by any of this? I'm not.
Understood.
And it's infuriating because, you know, on one hand, you're talking about we're bringing in, we're exploiting one class of people while another very small, very, very exclusive class, they get all the perks.
Yeah, and they seem to be doing quite well with the perks.
By screwing the people at the bottom, and that's what's so infuriating to me. It just, you know, when you see the, especially when you see them back to back, that's what really sends me off the deep end. Thieves. We should be building, I got a jobs plan. Building prisons to put those Wall Street criminals in.
There you go.
Put them right next to Jerry Sandusky, because I would argue what they've done to this country is just as bad as what Jerry Sandusky did here in Pennsylvania. Probably
I think many people feel that way. They're not getting punished.
Yeah, probably not a good segue into the next one, though, bringing up Sandusky. But it looks like the Boy Scouts are going to change their position on gay scouts?
They're looking at it. They're going to make a decision probably in the next week. They're actively considering an end to its decades-long policy of banning gay scouts or scout leaders. Now, if this is adopted by the organization's board of directors, it would represent a profound change on an issue that's been highly controversial. If you remember, it went to the Supreme Court, which said that the Boy Scouts could do what it liked. And it is under discussion. And what it would do is it would eliminate the ban from the national organization's rules, and it would leave local sponsoring organizations free to decide for themselves whether to admit gay scouts.
Right. You know, I'm not sure where I'm at on this, to be honest. I'm in the position of it should not even be a question. I shouldn't care. It should be about making better human beings and not about what you do with the confines of your four walls. And I wish we would stay out of other people's personal lives. And as my grandfather always said to me, don't worry about me, worry about yourself.
Yeah, you quoted that to me last week. I like that.
You know, or the other one when my mother said, when you point a finger at somebody, you got three pointing back at you. Kind of the same thing. I don't know. It tells you how screwed up as a society we are. And finally, Sarah Palin, a little split with Fox News. What's going on here? I thought she had her cash cow.
Well, they were paying her $1 million a year, and they chose not to renew the contract. They offered her significantly less than $1 million a year, and they couldn't come to a deal. So apparently they didn't want her that much. And so they parted ways amicably, apparently. And so what has happened is that Smart Politics has reviewed the more than 150 broadcasts that she did and found that she uttered more than 189,000 words, and it comes down to $15.85 a word.
Wow. How do I get that kind of per-word payment?
Yeah.
And the thing is most of her words aren't all that inspiring or intelligent or thoughtful.
I mean, think about it, really. Really? I mean, that means shucking and jiving cost $50.
But, you know, she had to actually sit down and think that up. So, you know,
she did.
You know, I'm sure she has a whole staff of writers and a whole bunch of people who focus group. Maybe she's got Frank Luntz on speed dial. You know, who knows? Maybe she puts a lot more into just, you know, these utterances that come out of, that just flow out of her mouth, kind of like, you know, never mind. But, you know, maybe this is focus-tested stuff. Maybe she's really putting in the hours here.
Maybe. You think?
No, I don't, but I'm trying to justify $15 a word.
You're trying? She only said you betcha twice. Yeah, she only said you betcha twice. she discussed President Obama by name 786 times.
So we should not have to pay her for President Obama or any of that, right? That should be just once, one pay there.
She said amen 111 times.
Amen. So let me ask you, did she, I mean, because she's very business-minded when it comes to this whole media, she's fairly media-savvy, I give her credit for that. Did she trademark You Betcha? I mean, is that hers? Because I know she was doing some things around, you know, the kids' names and her name and that stuff.
I don't think she's trademarked that one. I think, you know, if she could have done, she would have done.
Yeah, yeah.
I just think she can't. What she seems to be concentrating on now is a report to the FEC that's come out today shows she has $1.2 million in the bank with her Political Action Committee super PAC.
Right.
So basically she's got a lot of money in the bank, and she's apparently signaling she intends to become more involved in Republican primaries.
Oh, I'm sure they're thrilled about that.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled for them.
Yeah, it's going to help as they rebrand.
Nice. You know, I'm all in favor of it. And I want her to stay around. I was kind of sad to see her go away because she's kind of made a caricature of herself. Which
She's become the Sarah Palin that everybody painted her as.
Yeah. And good for her. I mean, you know, and now where's she going to go? Maybe Glenn Beck's got a spot for her.
Well, she did an interview with Breitbart, a three-question Q&A, and she was talking in it about, you know, going to, you know, she was looking to be in a broader place and this, but it sounded to me like she was doing like a job interview, not with them, but that she was basically saying, hey, I'm out here, I'm available, is anybody interested in hiring me?
Yeah, I'm going rogue.
Yeah, she was really basically saying, I'm available.
Yeah, well, you know, and I guess... Well, see, that's not even a nice thing for me to even think, the whole available part and being paid for it. And never mind.
Yeah, I wouldn't go there.
I'm not going. Victoria, it's been great talking with you.
Good to talk to you.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Today, a 1,000-year-old Buddhist statue, now believed to have been carved from a meteorite.
The statue is known as Iron Man. A Nazi-backed expedition to Tibet shipped it back to Germany shortly before World War II. Scientists from Germany and Austria have now used chemical analysis to conclude that this statue is carved from a piece of the Chinga iron meteorite, which fell near the border of Siberia and Mongolia around 15,000 years ago.
Gold prospectors in 1913 officially discovered the Chinga meteorite, but the statue is much older, perhaps 1,000 years old. It's 24 centimeters, less than 10 inches high. It weighs 10.6 kilograms, almost 24 pounds. In other words, it's heavy because it's made of iron.
The science team conducted an analysis of the iron, nickel, cobalt, and trace elements of a sample from the Buddhist Iron Man statue. They found that its geochemistry matches values known from fragments of the Chinga meteorite.
If the statue is in fact made from this meteorite, the piece turned into the Iron Man statue would be the third largest fragment of the meteorite known. These scientists published their study of the Iron Man statue in the journal Meteoritics and Planetary Science. To see a picture and find out more on this story, come to earthsky.org and search for the words Iron Man. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
The third agency of government, yes. I would do away with the education, commerce, And let's see. I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Oh, I'm surprised you didn't say the post office. Got to get rid of the post office. Privatize the post office. Surprised. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. As always, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Yes, destroy the post office, especially now that the price of a stamp has risen a whopping penny. 46 cents now. 46 cents to send a letter anywhere in the country. 46 cents. Yeah, I was just reading something the other day. You know, Canada's like a buck and a half. $1.20, buck, somewhere between $1.20 and $1.50, I guess. Look at the rest of the world where, you know, 46 cents, man. Anywhere in probably one of the biggest countries in 46 cents. And what we've got is we've got a situation where the right has done a masterful job of, again, poisoning something. You know, this whole we've got to fund those pensions, Rick. Much like they're doing with the same argument here with the state pension fund. They've made these big numbers up. They've created this crisis, and now it's about destroying it. And I love that. Oh, we're going to save it by killing it. We're going to save it. So, you know, much like Alan Simpson said about Social Security. Well, we've got to reform it so it works like it used to, where you're dead for several years before you can collect it. I mean, that's the gig. Especially the low wage, the little people at the bottom, you know, the people who do the hard work, like postal workers. But it went up to 46 cents from 45. In fact, they've come out with a global forever stamp that would allow you to mail a 1 ounce letter anywhere in the world for $1.10. Also, for you, those of you who like to send postcards, has gone up to another penny to 33 cents to send the postcard. Personally, I would like to see a story on how do we save the post office, not destroy it. And I've got the simple solution. Allow them to operate their pension like everybody else. Have the same rules for everybody. Much like we've not done with charter schools and cyber charters. Same rules. Everybody, apples, apples, oranges, oranges, pretty simple stuff. Let them compete. If you're one of those people who say, I believe in competition, Rick, let them compete. Just a thought. Also, today in labor history, the very first unemployment compensation law was passed and enacted in the state of Wisconsin, 1932. And ever since, you have seen the right wing of this country losing their ever-loving minds, trying to figure out how they can destroy it, and like I talked about earlier from Ron's email. Right, look at what they did and what they're trying to do in North Carolina. Drop it from $500 down, maximum down to $350. Change the calculation for the weeks from a 26-week period, which is kind of standard across the country. And now you're seeing a number of states go into this sliding scale. Depending on the unemployment rate, it would be between 20 and 12. Because we want to make sure that you're desperate enough to take the first thing that's available. Which I would argue is bad for the economy. Just a thought. But you look at what we did in Pennsylvania and all of the sham, which now folks are finally waking up to because, it's law. And they're going to allow the unemployment comp number, the number that you get in your paycheck, you know, because you were unemployed through no fault of your own, they're going to allow that to be eaten away by inflation for the next decade. Thanks a lot, Republicans. Appreciate that. While you're giving $1 billion away. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. You can email me, rick@ricksmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the good of sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.